It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. Amy Webb joins us, futurist Amy Webb. Rob Reed's also here, science fiction author. His new book just came out. And, of course, Ian Thompson, our old friend from The Register. We'll talk about that embarrassing Google memo. The iGeneration. Is something wrong with kids today? We'll actually have an actual kid visiting the show. And lots more to talk about, including DJI and the United States Army. It's all coming up next on Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 626, recorded Sunday, August 6th, 2017. CEO Barbie. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Stamps.com. Start using your time more effectively with Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, right from your desk. To get my special offer, go to Stamps.com, click the microphone, and enter Twit. And by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/twit2. And by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price, because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/twit. And entering the promo code TWIT. And This Week in Tech is literally brought to you by Sonic, Twit's 10 gigabit fiber internet service provider. Join Sonic's internet revolution as they bring fast, affordable internet, phone, and TV to homes and businesses all over California. Visit sonic.com/twit to sign up for service and receive your first month free. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. And one of the fun things about doing this show for me is I get to bring in whoever I damn well please. Fun people that I... It's always somebody I say, the week, you know, right, Carson? Oh, I want to talk to Rob Reed. Can we get Rob Reed on? And lo and behold, he appears.
It's here.
I said your name three times.
I wondered what was going on. I was sitting in my living room in New York City,
puff,
and then
a puff of sulfurous smoke.
Here I am.
Rob, as you probably all know, but if you don't, you ought to, is a good friend of the network. He was a multiple entrepreneur, created Listen.com, Rhapsody, then took his experience in the music industry to write a book that was a really good book called Year Zero about aliens and pop music. It's a complicated story.
Yeah, and they love our pop music.
They love our
vast alien civilization that is way too into American pop music, and it causes problems.
You said, though, you told me in an email you were worried about the sophomore jinx, your second novel, your third book, but your second novel.
Fourth book, actually.
Fourth?
But second novel, yeah.
So
I mean,
Year Zero was a play on Year One, your book about your first year in law school, right?
Yeah, it was a joke with myself in business school. It was kind of a joke with myself. It was like a working title. So my first book was called Year One.
Right.
It was about being a first-year student at Harvard Business School. I wrote it long ago, and I was a first-year student at Harvard Business School. And then when I made the pivot to writing fiction, which is a giant step in literature, it's basically a reset button. Just as a playful joke for myself, I had my working file. I just called it Year Zero.
Cool.
And it was a phrase that I used in the book. It was a phrase I genuinely used in the book. But then the folks at Random House really liked that as a title. I was like, it's going to cause a little confusion with the old book. They're like, don't worry, Rob. Nobody read that book.
Oh, meow.
It was true.
Ow. His newest just came out August 1st. I was at the reading, the Booksmith that you did on day one.
On day one at Hate
Of Year One. And the new book is called After On. And it is truly a masterpiece. John Slonina has been saying, finish it, Leo, so we can talk about it. He says, I don't want to give you any spoilers. There's some spoilers. No spoilers here today. But it is really a great book about a near future Silicon Valley.
9 seconds in the future, Leo.
Yeah.
That's very near future. Yeah. It's incumbent on the reader to read it very quickly. It takes place 9 seconds from when you start reading it. So it is a long book, so you have to read it rapidly lest it fall into the past. But yeah, it's set in present day San Francisco and an imaginary startup, a rather diabolical social media company. And everything that's in it, I researched pretty rigorously with long conversations with scientists and technologists. So the tech is very much grounded in what could just happen tomorrow or 9 seconds from now.
And I know you did a podcast with Tom Merritt. There's what, 8 or 9 episodes coming?
Yeah, there's so what we're doing is we're doing an 8-episode podcast, and it may persist, actually, because I've found that I'm having so much fun with it. I may just keep going with it. But basically, I interviewed so many fascinating people in preparation to write the book, and I ended up learning so much about the main topics of the book, which include synthetic biology and quantum computing. There's a great deal about superintelligence risk and a lot of other stuff. And I found myself wanting to inject these, like, 10-page digressions about how cool synthetic biology is at this moment. And that's bad storytelling. So my reward to myself for my compromise was we're going to do a bunch of podcasts in which are basically very long form interviews with scientists, technologists, thinkers, founders that go deep into the technology and the science that's connected to the book. And then also the geopolitical issues. There's a lot about terrorism. And so I interviewed Sam Harris at great length for one of the podcasts. And so those premiered on Thursday, actually, 2 days after the book. And Tom Merritt is my host, which is fantastic because he is extremely seasoned and has all the experience in podcasting that I personally lack. And it's been a blast.
Well, we're thrilled to have you so shortly after the release of the book on Audible. But you can get you can also get it at Kindle, and you can get it at Amazon if you want the Dead Tree edition. And I have 3 copies, and I didn't have any of them here. They're all at home. But thank you for bringing in your copy. After On is the name of the book. Also joining us, Amy Webb. You may remember Amy, her appearance a few months ago on Triangulation, talking about her book, The Signals Are Talking, in which she gives away the secrets of her business. She's a futurist and tells you how you can look at what's going on today, the signals, and determine what might be happening tomorrow, why today's fringe is tomorrow's mainstream. Amy, great to have you back on the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Book's doing great. I see you just got a business, 2017 business award?
Yeah, it's won some awards. It's hit some bestseller lists. Nice. It's doing well. It just went into a 6th printing, so people are reading it.
That's awesome.
That's great.
Yeah.
Nice one.
Yeah.
And Ian Thompson, who is not plugging a book.
I have no book to plug. I'm terribly sorry, but, you know, I do... writes a considerable amount during each week. So, you know.
Well, he writes a lot at theregister.co.uk, and I saw your, I saw your upset. There, look, see all of that about Marcus Hutchins.
Yes.
So this is a really interesting story. He came out for DEF CON. He's a hacker.
Yep.
He was the guy, you may know the name, because he was the guy when WannaCry, the ransomware, was ravaging Europe a few months ago. He was the guy who noted in the source code that there was a domain name, a really long, crazy domain name, and it wasn't registered.
Yep.
And so he registered it and turned out to be the kill switch.
Pretty much.
Written in probably by the North Korean authors of WannaCry. We think it was North Korea. Who does Donald Trump think it was?
Opinion is divided. Donald Trump.
It's a state. It's probably a state.
There are elements of state-sponsored coding in there. Certainly, if you look at the way that it was put together, its use of ex-NSA exploits, but also a whole bunch of other stuff as well.
It was not an amateur. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the kill switch makes sense if it's state-sponsored because you want a way to stop its spread if it should get out somewhere you didn't want it to, like in North Korea.
Indeed.
So there was a kill switch. Marcus found it.
Yep.
Set it off. Saved the world. Except it brought him to the attention of U.S. federal authorities. Tell us what happened after DEF CON.
Well, he came out to I don't think he actually went to the DEF CON conference.
He was here for Black Hat? Or?
No, I mean, he came out with a whole bunch of friends. There's been an awful lot of misdirection going on here. He didn't come out on a thousands of dollars expenses paid vacation. He stayed in an Airbnb with 8 friends. And yes, it was a very expensive Airbnb.
In Vegas.
Yeah, but at the same time, it came down to less than the cost of my hotel room in the Flamingo for the Saturday night.
Okay.
And if I could tell you some stories about that hotel. But
please, no.
But no, I mean, no. He came out, he did the party circuit, he met some people, he did what British tourists in Las Vegas always do, which was you go to a gun range, you go to the Grand Canyon, you go to a gambling hall. And
it's not coincidental that his decision to vacation in Vegas was during Black Hat and DEF CON, though.
Oh, no, it? No, I mean, but...
His friends were here for...
Well, yeah, I mean...
But he didn't go to the conference?
For that week, you have B-Sides, you've got Black Hat,
right.
You've got DEF CON. It's the biggest collection of hackers in the U.S.
Right.
He came out here for this. He went to some parties. He had some fun.
Right.
And then as he was about to board the plane,
he was actually
at
the airport on the way home. Where's he from, Britain?
Yeah.
That they arrested him. Now, that, by the way, is SOP, right? Because if you're at the airport, it's a lot easier to arrest somebody.
Yeah. Mm. You've got a bunch of TSA people around who are so bored that they've got nothing else to do but to take
arrest. It's a controlled environment.
You've got a lot of armed police around. Yeah. It's a good way to catch someone if you're actually doing it.
But it does send a chilling effect to other security researchers
coming
to the United States that they might be arrested. Now, if...
But they didn't bust him for helping us with WannaCry, right?
No, they busted him because...
It's a different accusation. Right?
He admitted to writing Kronos, right? The Trojan?
No, this is another thing. He has... His attorney has as of Friday afternoon, had barely spoken to the guy. So we don't know exactly what he's told the authorities. Now, he did write a blog post in 2014 putting together a piece of potential malware but crippling it so it couldn't possibly be used.
Yeah, like his instruction, right? I mean, it was anti-malware instruction.
Yeah, exactly. You can't research malware unless you know how malware works.
Yeah, and he really did it to train.
Sounds like, though, making a lot of excuses for the guy. The malware the thing he created ended up being sold as malware. Am I wrong?
Actually, no. The thing he created was a Windows XP bootloader. So
it had nothing to do with Kronos.
As far as we can tell, it had nothing at all to do with Kronos.
He has been arrested, however, for writing Kronos. Not for selling it, but his buddy ended up putting it on the market.
Buddy is possibly a bit strong. The guy's name has been...
Acquaintance?
His co-conspirator, to use the FBI's term...
Who has not been charged, we should point out.
And has not even been named.
The supposition is he probably turned state's evidence.
Well, it's either that he turned state's evidence or that they don't know exactly where to get their hands on him and they don't want to warn him of what's coming on.
Yeah. Well, he's kind of warned.
It all seems to be...
ask me. he knows his name. It doesn't matter if we know his name.
Yeah, but it all comes down to... I mean, I've read through all the court documents, the indictment, the rest of it. It basically seems to come down to his word against Marcus's.
Interesting.
So
you've read the Fed's indictment?
Yep. The heavily redacted Fed's indictment, yes.
And it's so he's, by the way, being...
Wasn't there a question about what, for a while, didn't like sort of nobody know where he was? Because the U.S. Marshals had taken him, right?
Yeah,
and
he had
18 there was like a big question as to like nobody could find him for a while. And,
yeah, there were 18 hours where nobody, not his family, not his friends, knew where he was. I was calling around jails in the Nevada area trying to find out if he was there. Other journalists were doing the same. The FBI finally came through and said, yeah, okay, we're holding him at our field office.
Right.
And they've been interrogating him there. I've got to say, as a Brit who, if I was coming to the US an awful lot and the FBI came round and said, you know what, we really need to talk and sat you down in an office for 18 hours, I'm not quite sure what I'd say. But
do you think he might have... confess to something?
I don't think he's...
They had an indictment written before they arrested
him. The indictment was filed on July 12th.
Feds, whether true or not, we don't know. You're guilty, proven innocent. He has pled not guilty. And by the way, the bail is not very high. It's $30,000 bail. Has he made bail? Is he still in prison?
It was a timing thing, right?
Yeah, basically.
They just couldn't get it done in 3 o'clock.
He went up into court at 3 o'clock. He was given a 30 grand bail. At 3:30, they then had to rush across town to get to the bail office. They didn't make it in time, so he spent the weekend in a jail. And then on Tuesday, he has to fly up to Wisconsin to go through the preliminary.
Upset? So, I don't pretend to know the facts. I just he was arrested. There's an indictment. Presumably, there's evidence that led to his arrest, which none of us know.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you upset about this?
I'm not upset so much as I think it's been massively overblown, but also it's going to have a really, really serious chilling effect on security researchers coming to this country.
Well...
Because after he got arrested, there are a whole bunch of people who I know in the field. Marcus has been a member of the InfoSec community for at least 5 years.
And is he respected?
He's respected. He does.
Is he a gray hat? White hat?
No, he's white. He does pro bono work for other malware researchers.
He was given $10,000 for stopping WannaCry, which he donated to charity.
Yep.
That's a good mark in my book.
And it was also given free pizza from his local pizzeria, which is just
which he did not donate to charity.
No.
I heard he ate that. So
I mean, seriously,
he's considered an ethical hacker.
He's considered an ethical hacker, certainly.
Well, here's what I...
Sure,
I was going to say, Well, here's what I think. Some of the problem is that we don't have clear case law on what constitutes, you know, a violation, right?
Mm-hmm. And in the past, the feds have been very overly aggressive. And Aaron Schwartz would be the kind of
that's holding it politely.
Big example. Somebody who really was
hounded into suicide, right,
and ended up killing himself. And so, yeah, I think there is this distrust of federal prosecution of hacking crimes.
But there's also, I mean, we're facing a difficult situation because we have a thing called the Wassenaar Agreement amongst 30 or 40 nations about what constitutes arms dealing. And under the current U.S. State Department rules, you know, simply having a fuzzer could be considered software arms dealing if you exported it outside of the U.S. So there's a tremendous disconnect between what the feds see as offensive hacking tools and what a lot of other people see as basic research tools that you need to do your job.
The feds don't understand what he wrote, that they didn't understand the purpose of it and misinterpreted it as malware?
Far be it from me to, you know, sort of disparage the good FBI people in Wisconsin, but I've got a reasonable expectation that they might have over-egged the pudding on this one. I mean, it comes just after Alpha Bay, and, you know, my first thought was they grabbed someone at Alpha Bay, said, spill your guts or you're going to prison for 30 years. He picked the first name out of a hat that he could come up with, and that's where the indictment came from.
If that's the case, then I'm sure that Marcus will be exonerated.
I'm really not, because considering the technical sophistication of most juries in this country, I mean, considering that it's a
if he is being prosecuted inappropriately and ends up getting punished inappropriately, that's exactly what the feds don't want, because nobody in their right mind will at that point help the U.S. government in trying to stop malware. I mean, that'll be that.
Well, that would be a good...
Yeah. I mean, he stopped WannaCry, and as a result, he's facing 40 years in prison. That is not the right outcome, unless, and I think it's perfectly possible, you know, hackers, it's perfectly possible that in addition to doing all this good stuff, he happened to write a banking Trojan that happened to bring down some banks. And
yeah, it is possible. However, I think you're assuming long-term rational thinking on behalf of the FBI. Yes.
You're assuming the opposite, however.
Well, no. What I'm saying is the FBI know that they need good security researchers to lock down, you know, to make
people
sure
our
computer systems are secure. But if you're a regional FBI officer who's looking to make a name for himself in the field,
right,
you go for what you think you can take down. Now, looking through the indictment, it is very thin, and they state that he definitely wrote the Kronos malware. Yeah. Now, they better have really good evidence for that, because people are going to take it apart.
People defending him said, well, he never made any money from it. You know, he didn't sell it.
Well,
but I think, and so I've heard some people say, well, it's like prosecuting the person who made the gun for the crime committed by the gun. But if you're writing malware,
mm-hmm,
I think that's a little different than making a gun.
Well, look at one of the people that went down for the TJ Maxx hacking incident. You had a programmer there who happened to write a fuzzer for somebody, not knowing that it was going to be used in malware. He got 2 years in prison for that.
Yeah.
You know, this guy...
That's wrong.
Yeah.
I'll grant you that.
All you've got to do with a jury like this is convince two-thirds or maybe three-quarters of people on the jury. And I've had a prosecutor say to me he worries about juries because it's basically made up of 12 people who couldn't work out how to get out of jury service.
Everybody who's ever been sued or prosecuted worries about juries. And I tell people, we have friends, family members who have been impaneled for juries. I say, serve. Because if you ever are on trial, you don't want it to be a jury of people who aren't smart enough to get off jury duty.
Exactly. No.
Right?
It's your duty if you're asked to serve on a jury. And
if you're technically literate, maybe you want to get on this jury.
If you're technically literate, chances are you'll be kicked off.
You get bounced off
the lawyers. Yeah. They don't want people who are technically literate.
One side does,
prosecution
one side doesn't.
Yeah.
At this point,
I don't know what there is to say about this. I think the facts aren't really well known. It doesn't seem like it's a strong indictment, but it was highly redacted. The other shoe hasn't dropped yet.
Yeah.
But I think we will watch this with interest, of course, as it
absolutely
develops.
And I just got to say I feel for the guy, because, you know, he's stuck in a country that he doesn't know very well. He can't leave it. His job's up for balance, and
Well, once he makes bail, I guess he's stuck in Vegas, right? I mean, so he's in.
Well, he's stuck in Wisconsin.
Oh, in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Honestly, I'd rather be in Wisconsin.
Prefer Wisconsin to
it's
Vegas.
It's a lovely time of year, actually, in Wisconsin.
And it's a lousy time of year.
It's a terrible time in Vegas.
I was there for all three conferences, and it was 105 degrees.
It would be much better to be in Wisconsin.
Yeah, humanity is not meant to live in under those kind of temperatures.
But at least he's only being imprisoned in a FBI field office, which I imagine is better than
he's
like
not in prison.
Being,
he's in an no, FBI he's a field, field office.
No, he's now in a local jail.
Oh, he is. Okay, got it. I was thinking like if I would take an FBI. The worst thing that could happen to you is probably awful coffee there. But now
I think
he's,
the safe thing to say is there is a chilling effect on security research. We've seen this before, this may well be another case of it. Where if
it also sets a. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. There's
no. Please, Amy, I want to hear from you.
I'm livid about this entire case because the real challenge is that it sets a precedent for law enforcement going after cases involving technology going forward. And the reality is that most law enforcement agencies and offices don't have enough technical competency.
Exactly.
And our laws are nowhere near close being able to keep up with the changes in technology, whether that's in hacking or in AI or in bioethics or, regardless of what it might be. So, this to me should be a national conversation, and it's not. And regardless of what happens to this guy and whether or not he serves time, there's going to be another case and another case and another case and another case. And that should have us all very, very concerned, all of us.
I was talking to researchers who were due to come out for DEF CON. One guy who's got dual French Moroccan citizenship, good respected bloke within the field, turned away. He applied with his Moroccan passport, was told no. Applied with his French passport, was told no. This is coming up again and again and again. And
was
after this arrest,
is he on some kind of like a list? Is there like a?
Well, no, he wasn't given a reason. That's part of the problem.
Wonder if there is something.
After the Marcus arrest. There was serious talk among the community, just like, well, are we going to come to DEF CON again? Are we going to do ShmooCon? Are we going to do, Derby Con? Are we actually going to go and share this information that we have with people?
At this point, you'd be nuts to come to the United States.
Yeah.
If there is any reason at all to think that you have a shadow on your record. If you're from Morocco, enough said. If you're from a primarily Muslim nation, enough said.
Yeah.
If you've ever touched a computer, enough said. I think that makes a lot of sense. And it's a shame for the United States. It's not that there are plenty of places people can go. There are plenty of places people can go for DEF CON. Mm-hmm. There's the Chaos Computer Club has a great conference.
A fantastic conference in Germany.
There's plenty of places you can go.
Mm-hmm.
They won't be coming here.
No.
I don't blame them.
As a result,
at this
a
point,
U.S.
I don't
will
blame
lose
them.
Out. Yeah.
Not that that's a good outcome.
It's important to note. We're not just missing out on tourism dollars. I mean, we're missing out on intellectual capital that we are going to need going forward. I mean, need now more than ever.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's, so fine, people jet in, they go to the conference and they leave. But while they're here, there's, physical face-to-face networking that happens. There's, transfer of knowledge. Maybe they stay and they do some work on behalf of us. I mean, this is a terrible precedent that's being set.
I mean, it's interesting because in effect, really, this is the terrorists winning. This is what happens
absolutely.
When a nation gets very afraid. And this started in 2001.
I know.
And it's what happens when a nation gets very afraid. They start doing things like this, but it has the negative, it has the exact reverse outcome.
Oh, that's right.
It doesn't make you safer.
It's playing entirely into the terrorists and the criminals game. Yeah. And I just wish Americans weren't such pussies about this sort of thing.
Marsworms remind. Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, I shouldn't.
As a pussy, I'm glad to say thank you.
No, you're one of the good guys, Leo. But I'm sorry, you've really got to get over this because terrorism happens.
Yeah.
And playing their game means we lose. So
it happens a lot more often in Europe even than it does here.
Well, look at the rise of nationalism everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that one of the side effects of this, right? This thing, this nativism, we can't let the other come into the country. Those are the people are the problem.
America was a country built on bringing people in.
We are the others.
Taking the skills. So.
This reminds me of a story. We talked about this on Security Now on Wednesday. Nice story about a Hungarian kid, teenager, 18 years old. There's a brand new subway system in Budapest, the BKK, the Budapest Public Transportation Authority. He found that on the website, you could buy a ticket, any ticket at all, and you set your own price because the form on the website was so poorly coded, you could just go behind the scenes in the HTML and change the price, and it would accept it, and you'd buy, you know, a $400 ticket for a penny.
Maybe they got old Priceline code that they built the website from.
Name
your price. I'll go for a forint.
He goes to the BKK and says, you know, you've got a problem on this website. He showed them the code. He didn't buy any tickets. Mm. I mean, he bought a ticket so he could show them the code, but he didn't use it. They arrested him. He's in jail. That's ordered a $35 ticket for 20 cents.
Ridiculous.
He is now in jail. This wasn't even hacking. This was looking at the underlying HTML. He went straight to them. He didn't buy tickets for his friends. Instead of thanking him, they called the police, had him arrested for hacking. This is a completely analogous story.
So basically, you can still get really cheap subway tickets in Budapest. Right?
They did not fix it.
Excellent.
They did not fix it.
Free subway all weekend long.
This is exactly what we saw 20 years ago in the US when people would call up companies and say, look, you've got this vulnerability. Far too many cases. They then got either legal hassles, they got the police knocking on the door.
Well, the Budapest Transport said, well, we've secured our system now. That's how they did it.
We locked the kid up. We locked him
other,
up.
Other white hats have scrutinized the site. One Twitter user called it a goddamn train wreck.
it's a little close to home.
Yeah. There are so many things wrong, but what it goes down to is a $1 million contract BKK with a Hungarian IT company that created this site. And basically, at this point, everybody's just covering their you-know-whats.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, there's an 18-year-old in Hungarian jail, which is somewhere you probably don't want to be.
Not quite Turkish bad, but still pretty bad.
Every time you say BKK, I feel like it's a Burger King managed, you know, subway system. Like, free Whoppers.
He had it his way.
Yeah, why would you want more BK?
Amy Webb is here. She's the author of The Signals Are Talking, a futurist. And I have a good one for you, Amy. We're going to talk about the Google memo when we come back. And you're going to explain to me, as an old white male, what's wrong with that. And we actually have a female Google engineer, just happens to be here from Germany. She's visiting.
Don't let her out.
She's not happy about it either. We'll find out what the women think. What do the ladies think of this memo?
I'll represent.
Will you represent? Thank you. I'm glad you're here, Amy. It's really good to have you. Rob Reed also here on the heels of his spectacular new book, which everyone has to read, After On at after-on.com.
Yeah, or listen to, Leo, because there's a...
I'm very briefly on it.
There's a well-known, yes.
Tom Merritt's on it. Yeah. Better, John Hodgman's on it, reading the phony Amazon reviews that it turns out you used to write as a hobby.
Yep.
And you have now incorporated into the novel. Is it the same reviews that you wrote?
Yeah. So to give a little background, back when I was running Rhapsody, which I found very stressful, part of me desperately wanted to be a fiction writer. And my personal therapy for late at night, after I was done with all my emails and all my managerial chores and all these things that were just so hard, I got online. And this is before the playful Amazon review became a thing. I started writing these kind of deranged Amazon reviews, and I called myself Charles Henry Higginsworth III of Boston, Massachusetts. It's this sort of character that I invented for myself, and he was like, you know, 20 years older than me and living in Boston in this crumbling mansion that it was an ancestral thing and they ran out of money and so he doesn't have money for heating oil. He'd start these reviews and he'd get about a third of the way in and do a 180 and start complaining about his life. I almost became a top 1,000 reviewer, which would have been really
But none
cool.
of these reviews were legit, right?
Well, no. Well, they were all by this Mr. Higginsworth character. So all these years later, I realized that these reviews that I wrote in 2002 and are still on the web actually could plug very nicely into the storytelling of this novel.
You were writing the novel even back then.
Even back. It's like Boyhood, right? Because they are still out there. And John Hodgman does read them on the audiobook.
He'd be perfect for this.
He is fantastic.
I'll just read the first sentence of this is the one you read and you're reading. This is a review of an actual book by the founder of Dunkin' Donuts called Time to Make the Donuts. The founder of Dunkin' Donuts shares an American story. And your reviewer... Higginsworth writes, like a charmed wind. You're going to love this. As writers, you're going to appreciate this. This is a great lead. Like a charmed wind hurling vital provisions onto a castaway's beach, fate landed a copy of this in a conference room in which I served a recent sentence to traffic school. As reading was a scorned pastime among my fellow inmates, I laid easy claim to the volume, a mental sop for a mind numbed by the day's prattle. That'll give you some idea. Hodgman does it better.
Hodgman does it beautifully. Yeah,
I'm on it. Tom Merritt's on it. You actually have some great people on the audio version of this.
Felicia Day.
Felicia Day. It's
Pat
on
Rothfuss. Yeah, great folks.
Patrick Rothfuss.
Yes.
Name of the wind.
Name of the wind. Yeah.
Wow.
Magnificent book.
He reads this faux spy novel.
That's embedded in the broader novel.
I'm telling you. You look up picaresque, this novel has replaced Tom Jones in the dictionary. I don't know what I'm saying. I'm looking for ways to get on your log rolling.
Thank you.
That wasn't it.
One of the subjects of fun reviews, that was my one for... As an opening line, I thought I was rather proud of.
Yeah, that is greater. I've never written an Amazon review. I'm missing out on that. Amy, have you written an Amazon review?
I have written an Amazon review, but I'm one of those people that is on the opposite ends of the bell curve, right? So like most people, I write when I'm extremely disappointed or extremely happy.
Right.
Yeah, it's usually an extreme state. That's what drives me to Yelp and TripAdvisor and things like that.
I've just got one of my last Yelp reviews up here, and it begins, I would sooner apply cheese grater to my scrotum than use Easy Bus again.
That should be in your novel.
That's one day.
Ian Thompson from theregister.co.uk. We'll have more on Twit in just a second. Our show today brought to you by Stamps.com, the post office in your office. You don't need to go to the post office anymore because you've got Stamps.com and everything you could do at the U.S. Postal Service. You could, well, not if you're in Albania, but if you're in the United States, you could do from your desk with Stamps.com. You can buy and print real U.S. postage. You do not need special ink. You do not need a special postage meter. You just need your computer, your printer, and Stamps.com. And I have to say, if you do mailing of any kind in your business, this is, it's just a no-brainer. You got to do this. But especially if you sell things online, if you sell at Etsy or eBay or Amazon, I get so many packages that just look, well, like they were made on Etsy. Like they were handmade, right, with twine and licked stamps going around the side, and they put too many stamps on. You want to give a little bit more professional appearance to your mailing, you got to try stamps.com. First of all, we're going to give you an offer that comes with a USB scale, so you always have exactly the right postage. No putting on extra stamps just in case. You can actually print stamps from stamps.com, but most people will put the package on the scale and print a very nice label for the package. You can also print right on the envelopes. Your label will include your return address, your business logo. It will even populate the address from the website, so you don't have to type anything in. If you are selling overseas, it does all the customs forms automatically for you. If you're doing certified mail or some other fancy mail where you have forms to fill out, it will fill out the forms for you. You even get discounts you can't get at the post office on stamps.com. Print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail. It even suggests the right class. So, Rob, if you're mailing out your book, it'll say, you know, these are books. Or you want to do media mail and save you big money. Stamps.com. It's easy to create your account. No special equipment to lease. No long-term commitments. And we've got a special offer that gives you a chance to try Stamps.com and get some really nice stuff. Go to Stamps.com. Click the microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Use our offer code TWIT, T-W-I-T. And we've got a $110 bonus offer that includes $55 in free postage that you can use over the first few months. You can't use it all once, but a few months. It'd be good for your Christmas mailing list. How about that? You also get that great USB scale. You get a supply kit. You also get a free 30-day trial of stamps.com. Actually, I can't say free because you have to pay postage on the mail, on the scale. It's about $5. That's why they give you the $5 activity kit. It's a no-risk trial offer. How about that? Stamps.com. We've used it for years, and if you're doing mailing, you should do it too. You can thank me later. Stamps.com. And don't forget the offer code TWIT. Actually, that's how you thank me. We're talking about the week's tech news. It's so funny. Rob brought his, because last week we were talking about Apple phasing out the Shuffle and the Nano, right? And you brought your original Shuffle. That's the one you hang around your neck.
Yeah, it was in the show notes. I hadn't realized you covered it last week. But yeah, I got this. I think it was in January of 2005.
That was the dopiest thing. Remember Steve Jobs said, what we found is nobody really wants to know what they're playing. They just want to play it.
Yeah.
And just for history's sake.
Steve was
sake,
such a good salesman. What's
I
that?
Also bought the Diamond Multimedia Rio. My baby's first MP3 player could carry all of 30 minutes of very low resolution.
That was,
how much could you get on the Shuffle?
The Shuffle, this one was an 8-hour one, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think this was one of the fancy
just
ones.
Just no control out. Over what you're listening to. Just
absolutely
all you
none.
Could do is yeah. Shuffle it.
All you could do is shuffle.
And then they made one shuffle that was the, so that was the size of a Wrigley's, Dickus Wrigley's, and then they made one the size of a Dentine.
Oh, this
right?
is a mainframe. Yeah.
And then there's
this
one
is a mainframe compared to what they did. They ended up being like tie clips.
Yeah, tie clips. All right, Amy, we're going to put you on the spot. You have to represent all of womankind. Although a number of men jumped in on this. So apparently there was a memo placed by a Googler, as yet unnamed Googler, although if his name is ever revealed, I think we'll find out about it. He posted it on apparently a Google meme site, as well as the internal equivalent of Google Plus. And the full content of the memo has been finally revealed by Gizmodo. They got it. Wasn't probably very hard. And I'm going to try to characterize this so that people can react to it. The reaction's been very, very strong. You know, Google has had a diversity problem. The FTC's been trying to investigate them. Google said, no, you can't have any documents. Google says, we're satisfied that we're doing enough to hire more women and more minorities. It's apparent, though, if you look at the numbers, they're not. Women engineers represent 1 in 5 Googlers. African-Americans and Hispanics, even worse. I think it's 1 or 2%. African-American engineers at Google's engineering division in the United States. But this this memo says, well, this is just another form of discrimination, all this attempt to, let me see if I can find the text of it.
It's pretty long.
Yeah, I don't want to read it.
I can summarize.
Can you, Amy? Go ahead.
So there are different sections of it, but the gist, the sort of gist of it is women don't make good coders, according to the person who wrote this, because...
they're genetically just not suited.
Right. Genetically and socially not suited. Now...
They have other skills, he's saying.
Right. But women are extroverts, men are introverts. Right. So there's like a whole litany of
women
of
like people,
why.
Men like machines
right.
or things. This is so, like Larry Summers, the then president of Harvard, saying, well, women aren't good mathematicians. It's just genetically the case.
Ada Lovelace.
Yeah. Here's what I would say. My viewpoint on this is possibly a little controversial. I don't think so. But you know, I would say that we are not all the same. That, you know, women and men are not the same. But I would also say that within women, there's quite a bit of diversity, just like there's quite a bit of diversity within men. The three of you sitting at that table are not, you know, archetypes or carbon copies,
no.
right, of each other. At least I don't think so. And by this guy's definition, you know, I would read like a 16-year-old teenage boy. If we agree with what he, you know, how he delineates the genders in the memo. So there's a couple of things going on. He's making broad generalizations about women and about men, which any sociologist would tell you don't track. So his generalizations all, you know, and anybody who's a coder has taken math,
right.
which means that He should have known better than to generalize to begin with.
He says, science will back me up. The sociology proves that...
It doesn't.
But it doesn't. So that's point one. He's just wrong.
Point two, this had to have been a pretty low-level engineer because the way that he's describing some of the work would tell me that he hasn't yet worked on any more advanced projects at Google. He's probably like an entry-level 23-year-old kid. Nothing, you know, not that there's anything wrong with 23-year-old kids, but what it does tell me is that, you know, his work has been binary. So he hasn't had to solve any real problems.
Right.
And anybody who's ever had to think about the future or about the past or solve any real problems understands that biodiversity is a good thing.
Yes.
You know, and that teams are requisite. So to me, you know, this was probably written by somebody in reaction to either a bad performance review or a bad day at work or, you know, feeling left out of the club, or maybe he got rejected by a fellow coder, developer who happened to be a woman. You know, it could have been any of those things, but there's so much inexperience throughout the entire memo to me that, you know, it sounds like some petulant 20-year-old who's you know, who doesn't have a lot of experience and doesn't know what he's talking about anyway. So I wasn't super angry or upset by the memo. Right. Now, what's been interesting is the reaction to that memo, which to me almost feels a little inauthentic. It feels as though in the year 20, what was the year that movie PCU came out? Do you guys remember that movie? It was like early Jeremy Piven.
It was quite some time ago. It was like 94, 95.
I feel like we've circled, you know, all of history, cycle,
you're right?
Yeah, I feel like we've hit that cycle again where our responses are expected. And I feel like some of the responses that I've seen to this memo have almost been formulaic.
What about Google's response, though? That's the one that really matters. And some people have been critical about the Google management's response to this, which was, we want to make a safe place at Google for all beliefs, including these beliefs.
Which is why, what
was
made
that
me
an official,
think
was that a press release that they...
Yeah, that was their official response to it.
Right, right. They just hired a diversity head.
Yeah, she's literally been in the job 2 weeks and then this blows up.
So it's interesting you say what you said, Amy, because I before the show, you mentioned you hadn't read Yonatan Zunger's Medium piece about this.
No. I had.
You
I
had. Okay.
Yeah.
So he
yeah.
was, he's actually.
And he said the same thing.
He said exactly the same thing. He's a very well-known Googler, very politically active. He has recently left Google. So he said, well, I could speak a little more freely about this than I would have if I were still a manager at Google. And he said exactly the same thing. He said, when you first start coding, you are just dealing with a machine. But as you get more senior, you realize really the job is not coding. The job is solving problems, and in particular, interacting with other people to solve those problems. It isn't. And I think you're right. I think a lot of young coders starting off think what coding is all about is learning how to instruct the machine. And he says, essentially, this is Younger, engineering is all about cooperation, collaboration, and empathy for both your colleagues and customers, something that the memo writer said, oh, those are female traits. If someone told you engineering was a field where you could get away with not dealing with people or feelings, then I'm very sorry to tell you, you've been lied to. Solitary work is something that only happens at the most junior levels. And in fact, the traits which the manifesto described as female are the core traits which make someone successful at engineering. But I think the bigger issue, Amy, is that the lack of diversity at Google and in Silicon Valley, does it hurt Google? Does it hurt the product?
Well, I would say yes. And I would say, you know, one of the things that I'm researching most intently is artificial intelligence. So that's been a big part of my life for the past couple of years. And you can see the strange and weird ways that AI is starting to break or break down. And that's you know, a result of having too few people with too narrow a worldview trying to solve problems together. So, you know, everybody that I know that works in tech likes to talk incessantly about nature, and yet they seem to not take some very basic cues from nature. Nature tells us, you know, that biodiversity is good for the ecosystem. And it's always good to introduce, you know, complementary species and life forms, you know, to be together. What I find so interesting is that we see, you know, study after study and anecdotally and just evidence all around the biodiversity is great. And yet we don't seem to take that advice when it comes to staffing the offices.
It's a monoculture.
You know, where the stuff is being built. Right. Now, you know, it's difficult. And it's hard to have this conversation without using those broad generalizations.
Right. Well, that's, you know, so I want you to school me because, and I'm going to walk right into a minefield here.
But that's okay. I want to be educated here. It is true that, I mean, and of course, every individual is a unique individual. And many guys have more female traits. Many women have more male traits, whatever. My wife is much butcher than I am. But you, it seems to me there are there gender differences?
Well, I think it depends on who you ask, right? I think Dinesh D'Souza, who's a right-wing conservative writer, would tell you that stereotypes are born out of fact and that they exist for a reason. I think that any sociologist who's had any real training would tell you that it depends on the data set. And gender is not just influenced biologically, but also by right. the cultural norms and standards in each country right. and region and everything else.
And yet, you have kids, right?
Yeah, I have a kid, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, we have a boy and a girl. And I'm pretty convinced that we did not in any way try to push them in any direction. But the boy liked playing with, guns and yeah. balls, and the girl did not.
Right. There,
and this was out of the womb. This was very early on. I don't think this was socialization. So I agree. There's a massive debate over nature versus nurture. And I don't. Right. And it's very hard to know what's nature and what's nurture. I guess. Look, I don't. I think we do need diversity. Clearly, we need diversity in Silicon Valley and everywhere. Every workplace is better. If it's a diverse workplace, it's just better for everything, for everybody mm-hmm. in the workplace. I know that. That's true. But part of the reason that's true is because people bring different flavors to it. And I think I don't think it's unreasonable to observe that women bring different flavors than men. Or is that really a bad thing to look at?
Here's what I would say. Humans are not wired for change. We are, our limbic systems react very poorly when the status quo is challenged. That puts us into fight or flight mode, and it causes us to make bad decisions. And more importantly, it causes us to pine for the way that things used to be. And it's because of our limbic systems that, a lot of people are not good at thinking about the future. However, if we look from a statistical standpoint, that change is often better. Right. And that it helps us approach and understand the future in a better way. What's happening right now is that technology has, reached a certain inflection point. We have enough people who are trained that can go into the field. We have enough compute power to be able to work on meaningful projects. And, because of how things have always been, those roles are predominantly dominated by white males and males from other, a few other countries. So this is really about change. And it happens through every field. If you look throughout time, it's happened in every field and in every case. And once that change happens and the workforce has become more diversified, they tend to be more productive. They do better. There's all this data showing that. So I think when it comes down to it, we're just dealing with the latest round of this. And we feel it and sense it acutely because it's the field that we all pay attention, that us, the people who are on this show and who are listening to this show, watching it, it feels acute because we pay attention to it. But it's the same story that's been written over and over again, in law and in academia and, in all of these other different fields and industries.
I remember talking to man named Jonathan Haidt. You probably know his stuff. He wrote a book called The Righteous Mind, Why Gold People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. He's an interesting fellow with some very interesting points of view, somewhat echoed, by the way, in this Google memo. This is such a complicated subject. I want us to do this in a succinct way so we can move on. But I'd also, the memo says that there is unconscious bias at Google, but it's unconscious bias towards what we traditionally call the left, as opposed to the right. He says the bias in the left, and this is what Jonathan Haidt's research also shows, things like mercy, compassion for the weak, disparities, a real sense of disparities due to injustice, open, idealistic. And by the way, one of the things he says echoes what you just said, Amy, the left's bias is towards change is good. The right or conservative, let's maybe say conservative versus mm-hmm. liberal, but conservative mm-hmm. bias would be respect for authority, humans are competitive, change is dangerous. We're more pragmatic. He says Google errs so far on the liberal side that it misses some values that the conservative side could offer. For instance, he says it's a good thing to have a programmer who doesn't like change, who wants to maintain a product. And the problem, Google does have this problem where nobody wants to maintain an existing product. They all want to go to the next thing. And he says, in a company too far to the left will constantly be changing, deprecating much-loved services, over-diversify its interests, ignoring or being ashamed of its core business, and overly trust its employees and competitors. He says it could do with a little bit of this more conservative thinking. And Jonathan Haidt says neither side is right. Haidt says neither side is right in this, but there are these very different ways of looking at the world. And I don't think this memo is wrong in one sense. Mm-hmm. Google is, and most of Silicon Valley is so progressive focused that there isn't a lot of room for somebody who's more conservative.
So how many – do any of the three of you happen to know how many people work at Google?
Well, it depends. Do you mean like engineers or do you mean in general?
Just in general.
I've got a feeling it's 121,000, but I'm not entirely sure.
It's a lot. It's six figures.
It's a lot. Yeah. It's a lot. So statistically speaking, isn't it possible that, just like any other group of people in any other bell curve, you've got a bunch of people who are in the middle.
Yep.
You have a bunch of people who are out, and then you have your outliers, right? Again, I think I worry about hive mind mentality circulating
in any direction.
In any case, but also having it specifically to do with this memo. This memo goes wrong as far as I'm concerned because of the broad generalizations that it makes.
That's always a danger, yeah.
That's right. But, and this is I was a debate nerd all the way through high school and college. If I put my debating hat back on, there's no way that I could argue any argument that comes out of the assertions that are being made due to these broad strokes is a completely worthless argument, right?
It's pathos, and not logos or something like that.
Well, but for us Google is not specifically hiring people who are left of the political spectrum. There are a lot of people who work at that company, and this is not in defense of Google. Google has some serious problems when it comes to diversity. But I just think we ought to be careful and cautious in making these assertions that everybody at Google is, left-leaning, everybody in Silicon Valley is left-leaning.
Well, we know it's not true.
I know of a Trump voter who works at Google.
Yeah. No, we know that's not true.
It happens, but I mean...
But isn't there a bias? But I guess what he's saying, this memo writer is saying...
There's a bunch of unconscious bias.
Yes.
But that unconscious bias is in a different place. And you can see that in, let's do a little thought experiment. Go to Google image search and type in CEO.
Screen.
All right. Who is the first woman CEO that shows up?
Oh, this is a good test. Let's see.
Images.
I haven't done this in a couple.
Man. A lot of clip art. Man. Well, let's see. Here's the first.
Pepsi, right?
Wait a minute. Here's another one. Okay. I had to go to two rows. Charity Navigator CEO compensation study. I think that's clip art.
I think
that's clip art. Here's an actual CEO
being sworn in.
Right. Can you scroll down a little bit?
Yeah.
Because I'm actually there. She is. No. Okay, it's not on your computer. Oh, there it is. Do you see CEO Barbie?
CEO Barbie, right in there.
So for a long time, that was the first woman that showed, the first female that showed up.
So Google fixed that.
She's wearing a micro mini skirt.
I think Google fixed it this morning.
But the interesting question is, why is that? Is this algorithmic? This is not a human.
This is unconscious bias because in our culture in America, when we say CEO, women and men, left-leaning and right-leaning, are trained to think of, old white dude.
CEO
so,
Barbie.
And
by the way, that's the response that a lot of people would say, well, no, this is what we'll do. We'll make a CEO Barbie in a miniskirt. That'll fix it.
That'll fix everything.
My wife is the CEO of this company and is a CEO and writ large. And I know the only CEO I really know is a woman. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So again, and to be fair, overwhelmingly, women are not CEOs of companies, there, you know, as again, it, like as a statistical sample size, you know, we are smaller. So my point is there is unconscious bias. There is a diversity problem at Google. Right. And the person who wrote this memo was obviously very, very young and feeling, you know, disparaged at work. Right. And, you know, but again, the conversation that we ought to be having, I think, is a different one. You know, and we should acknowledge that we're all pretty different. But even within our groups, we're really different. And if you want to spin this out, you know, I mentioned AI earlier. The thing that keeps me up, that I worry about, is that humans, you know, pretty soon we will not have the luxury of discriminating against each other in these little taxonomies that we understand, like gender and race. I think within the next 30 years, we're going to have algorithms that are sectioning us off in a more Huxleyan way. Yeah. And, you know, we're going to find ourselves in tribes that we don't even understand, and being lumped together by machines on the back end. And that will have real world consequences. But that's all being built by people like the dude who wrote that memo.
Yeah.
The foundations of it. So.
That's what Kathy O'Neill would also say. Weapons of mass destruction. We talked about her last week, when she's been on Triangulation. Is that there's this unconscious bias being written into these algorithms now? A lot of it from innumeracy, from math illiteracy, and a lot of it from a lack of diversity and ignorance. So,
I would say the one thing that where I read this memo and thought actually it's kind of like a stopped clock is twice.
It's right twice a day.
Yeah. He was just saying that the fact that I'm writing this is going to get decried by some people. And no, he's got a perfect right to write that and to get all these things out in print. What he doesn't have is a perfect right to be taken seriously and not criticized for inaccuracies or for failings in what he's written about.
Right.
There is a massive diversity problem in Silicon Valley. There is a much bigger racial diversity problem in Silicon Valley than there is a sexism problem. And that's not to minimize the sexism side of it, but we've got to get this sorted out, both as an industry and also as a society. Because you're right, Amy, the most diverse ecosystems are the ones which flourish the most, and we've really got to work towards attending those.
Well, and your point's well taken, is that we're about to enter an era where the code written by these people is going to impact our lives in every possible way. And you don't
right, and to segment us into, I mean, that's, you know, I think honestly, I think my child who's you know, young will look back 30 years from now on this, you know, the halcyon days when, you know, how quaint it was that we were writing, you know, memos about gender discrimination in our workplaces. You know, we're going to wind up, you know, truly in a sort of Brave New World sense, being segregated into different type of tribes for financial reasons and mental abilities and, you know, all different kinds of ways that we've never really thought through before. And we're assigning that decision-making ability to algorithms that are being written and tested by people who don't share the same worldviews as we do. Right. And that, to me, is a bigger problem. But I do think it's interesting that if we cycle back, we really have started to hit a fever pitch, I think, with regards to gender and race conversations and then people feeling very much like the conversation has gotten too far, which sort of reminds me of where we were in the late 90s. And I don't know why at this particular moment in time it's happened again, but it cycles.
I know this exactly is a why.
The economy?
Yeah, it's the economy. Of course, that's what it is.
Yeah.
We'll talk about your daughter. She's in the iGen, isn't she? I don't want to make this a sociology show. We'll find some other stuff to talk about, too. But at some point, we have to talk about this amazing article by Jean M. Twenge. It's an excerpt from her upcoming book about the iGen, the generation that have grown up with iPhones.
I wonder if she trademarked that before.
She has the website iGenConsulting.com.
It's fingernails on a blackboard to me, iGen. Like iGen brought to you by Apple.
Well, you know, I tweeted this article and a number of people said, oh, come on, do we have to label every freaking generation? Baby boomer,
Gen X, Gen Y, millennials.
We're running out of letters, to be fair. Like, after Gen Z, you either go into an entirely new alphabet.
I think iGen is a fair coin.
iGen isn't bad, but it's so
deliberate.
If only
Doug Copeland had started earlier in the alphabet, then we would
have. It should have been Generation L.
We're going back.
We wouldn't have to think for really long.
Her book, which this is an Atlantic article, is an excerpt from, is coming out later this month, is called, and this will tell you everything, iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious. By the way, she's a PhD. She studies generational differences. Yep. This is her. Mm-hmm. This is her bailiwick. Less rebellious, more tolerant, less happy, and completely unprepared for adulthood. And what this means for the rest
of us. Yeah, because there's never been anybody who's got poor by saying, God, the next generation don't know what they're up to.
Turn down that rock and roll, you kids, and cut your hair, Leo. Oh, wait,
I mean, it's the same way computers came when the personal computer came in the sort of the late 70s, early 80s. It's like, oh, these kids are just hammering away at a computer, and it's like, it'll be the death of them. And now we've got an entire industry built in Silicon Valley.
I do have to say, I didn't want to get in this conversation. We're going to take a break, but I do have to say, there is something going on because we have gotten very good in designing software that addicts you, mm-hmm. right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Very good.
Very deliberately. That way.
Yes. Gamifying.
Certainly. Yeah.
And it's dangerous.
Understands dopamine responses in the brain and works on that. Yeah.
That's what they're doing at Blizzard with World of Warcraft. They have all the data. This is what's changed. We have all the data. We know exactly how much time people spend in each raid, mm-hmm. what raids they like, what raids they don't like, and we can maximize the loot to make sure they spend more time online. And as a result, there are people who have died from playing World of Warcraft. There are people who have lost their families from playing World of
but
Warcraft.
But did they die happy, Leo?
They died with a full bladder. That's all I can
in
say.
Battle. That's true.
They died in battle.
That's what they died of.
In glory. I'm playing these stupid games. Yes, it's time for me to quickly play a little round of Field Runners. I play these games. They're very addictive. And I think that there is something to be said for the fact that we have a generation who are at the mercy of this stuff, who sleep with their phones. You just walk downtown, nobody's looking at anybody. They're all looking at their phones. And I'm just as guilty as anybody. But the difference is my brain was fully developed before this happened. What about the generation that's grown up in the last 10 years with the iPhone and Android phones, those young malleable brains, what about them? So I think that that's a legitimate cause for concern. I'm not sure we need to name them the iGen or fear what's going to happen.
But when you start an article, I mean, I know that the journalists,
it's link bait.
They're not the ones who write the titles, but nonetheless, have smartphones destroyed a generation?
Saved your click?
No. Rock and roll destroyed my generation.
Rock and roll was supposed to bring down the end of Sutter. With my generation, it was punk. You know, it's like.
And this then is different, though, than music. This is very addictive stuff. This is different even than the games we played when 20 years ago.
True, but it is so much less addictive than the pretzels filled with peanut butter
that you have
in the pantry.
I know. You should try them, Amy.
But everyone says, oh, no one's looking up and around. If you look at a photo, there was a marvelous photo from the British commuting train in going into London in the 1930s, and everybody has a newspaper over their face.
We don't like
no
each
one's
other.
Converse.
And
nobody wants
equally
to.
Walled off.
There are actually some physiological changes that are happening that will affect us in the future. My husband's an eye doctor, and so he's noticed over the past couple of years more and more people having all kinds of eye strain and issues, and that's because humans were really not designed to see near for longer periods of time. We were designed to see far, and our eyes, you know, our bodies are not evolving as quickly as the technology that we're using with our bodies. And so there are people having all kinds of eye related problems and strain and,
arthritis is also a big issue. I mean, I was talking to a doctor and they were saying that he's seeing people with hand arthritis problems in their 30s that he would expect to see in their 50s and 60s. Because they've spent their entire life texting on phones. Thumb problems in particular are becoming a major arthritic issue at the moment. Because
it all seems silly and funny, and we all sort of snicker about it, except that there's data to prove out everything that we're talking about. And at some point, you know, when you have spent all this time staring down and you've now got these headaches that don't go away and you've got, you know, your shoulders hurt, which is not, you know, it's not life-threatening, but it becomes, you know, you realize that you are causing your body to change.
Yeah, bottom right? line, we were designed to procreate and die at 30, though. So we're going to rent out the hardware one way or another. Like everything is, you know, man, I don't want to don't get me started about my ankles. My ankles were like, I thought I was supposed to be
this
done
is
at
over.
30.
What this are you doing nonsense. Walking around at yes. this advanced age? You're crazy. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll come back with more. And yes, we'll have some more tech, including Vic Gundotra throwing some shade at his former employer.
Speaking tiny bit of shade, tiny bit.
A little bit of shade. You like it how I use the language of the kids today? There's Facebook story. I think we have conclusive evidence that Mark Zuckerberg is running for president. We'll tell you what that is.
I think he's going to get beaten like a red-edged stepchild if he does, but yeah.
I don't care. I think it's going to be fascinating. And I don't know. We could talk about the Note 8. We could talk about Travis Kalanick attempting to get back in the driver's seat
at
the Uber.
The comeback kid.
The Game of Thrones hack. They call it the Game of Thrones hack. Really, it was a hack of HBO.
Yeah.
And a lot worse stuff than Game of Thrones.
Although apparently not their email system, but yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was about 1% of the data that North Korea got out of Sony. So, I mean, you're putting in things in perspective. But okay. Yeah, it's
serious stuff. It's all
clearly, none
up.
Of you are watching Game of Thrones.
Yes.
I am. I'm watching it religiously.
I'm a recent convert.
And no spoilers. I'm not going to watch the hacked pirate version of it. I want to watch it every Sunday night like you're supposed to.
I was a very late...
God intended.
I was a late convert. I'd always considered Game of Thrones to be basically dragons with nudity, but...
That's exactly right. And what did you find out
it actually is?
Well, actually, Peter Dinklage really
he's good,
rocks on that show.
And I think he's the hero, of all of it.
And right. Charles Dance as his father superb.
Not to spoil anything, but Charles Dance came to a bad end.
I'm saying nothing. No spoilers here.
Not that you're spoiling anything at all.
Okay. I know my wife used to, I've told this story before, but my wife never got into Game of Thrones, and I would sit and watch it religiously. And she'd always come in at the worst possible time.
I was trying to get my wife into Breaking Bad, and she'd come in at exactly the moment.
Softcore porn you're watching. This is not... I'm not going to watch that.
I could never get Breaking Bad because it was the whole premise of it. When you come from somewhere with a national healthcare system, you're just like, well, why doesn't he just...
Yeah.
Oh, this is America. Right. Okay.
That's a very good point. It's actually a very good point, right?
Yeah. You know, it's only in America.
For those who haven't watched it, the premise is that this guy is a high school science teacher who gets cancer, and in order to pay for his cancer treatments, turns his skills... to the dark side and
making crystal meth. Yeah. No spoiler. That's
but really good crystal.
Really good. It's blue. Well branded.
Really good crystal.
Yeah. Really good and crystal meth. Those phrases don't go together. But
so we're told.
I know nothing.
Our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage. If you know, I have to say, if you're getting a home loan these days, you might as well do it the 21st century way. Quicken Loans, one of the biggest and best lenders in the country, noticed that it was, frankly, an industry stuck in the 19th century. You know, you practically had quill pens and little sleeve garters and, you know, those green eye shades when you go in to get the loan. And, well, all right, let's bring your paperwork with you. And nowadays, we got computers. We've got a better way. And that's what Rocket Mortgage is, designed by Quicken Loans for us. The geeks. It's a totally online loan approval process. And what do you get because it's totally online? You get transparency, so you know exactly what's happening. The power's in your hands. You get the confidence that what you're doing is exactly what you need from a great lender. And most importantly, it's fast. It's all online. I want you to go to rocketmortgage.com/twit2. When you need a home loan, you could even be at an open house. Now, I have to say, the last home loan we got three years ago when Lisa and I bought our house took us 4 months. We were faxing. First, I had to find a fax machine. I would go down the Mail Depot down here. They have a fax machine. It's like this dusty old fax machine and at 10 cents a page. I was feeding the pages of the document because they wanted me to fax it to the bank. And that went on for weeks, literally more than a month. I think Lisa said it was a couple of months. So much so that we almost lost the house. The seller was saying, come on, guys, tell them what's going on. If only they'd had Rocket Mortgage. You could do this at an open house. You say, I like this house. Let's buy it. You pull out your phone. You go to rocketmortgage.com/twit2. Everything you need to do, you can do with the touch of a finger, including submit pay stubs and bank statements because it got trusted partnerships with all the financial institutions. It's all online. They can crunch the numbers. I mean, well, it's computers. It takes them seconds to crunch. It takes no time to crunch the numbers. There's no faxing involved. And they will present you with all the loans that you qualify for based on your income, your assets, and your credit. You pick the term. You pick the interest rate. You know exactly what's going on. It's just awesome. You're applying fast and easy. You're doing it confidently. You understand what's going on. This is Quicken Loans. I want you to try it. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently at rocketmortgage.com/twit2. That's twit and the number 2. rocketmortgage.com/twit2. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. And MLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. You can refi, too. Whether you're buying or refiing, rocketmortgage.com/twit and the number 2. And we thank them so much for making This Week in Tech possible. Ah, there's so many things we could talk about here. What do you want to talk about? Amy, what you got? Is there something that you're looking at going, this is something important that happened this week? I don't know. I don't know where to go.
There was a lot.
We did the two big ones.
You want to talk about Vic?
Vic Gundotra. So Vic used to work at Microsoft, right? He was an executive there, got a job at Google, and his first job there was interfacing with Apple, with Steve Jobs, on the Google apps for the iPhone, mm-hmm. in the early days of the iPhone. He tells great stories. Vic told great stories about how Steve would call him one Sunday. He'd call him, and Vic didn't answer because he was at church. He was at services. And later calls Steve back, and Steve said, why didn't you call me back? He said, well, I was at services. He says, oh, well, that's different. He says, the color of the O on your Google app is wrong. You got to change it, and things like that. Anyway, great stories. But then Vic became completely enamored of social and said, Google is missing out. We're not getting so much. There's so much data that Facebook and Twitter get from social. Social's got to be our bottom line. He lobbied Larry Page mercilessly, incessantly for more than a year, I'm told, and finally got Google Plus off the ground. That was Vic Gundotra's baby.
Wasn't that a success?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't a great baby, but it was a funny looking kid. But anyway, he then left after the kind of the failure of Google Plus. I think he left not in disgrace, but, you know, he said, well, all right, fine. It didn't work out. He has actually started an interesting startup called Cardia, which I have. It's a EKG in a little device that goes to your phone. You can get a doctor to read it if you've got AFib, which I don't have. But Jeff Jarvis, who's on Twig, does, and he uses it and sends it to his doctor, and it's a great way to diagnostic. It's one of the few FDA-approved iPhone devices out there.
Mm-hmm.
So he's doing great. But for some reason, he's decided he just wanted one last shot to Google, and he did it, and I think this is not an accident, on Facebook. He posted pictures of his daughters, beautiful pictures, taken with an iPhone, and announced... This is the iPhone is so good. Throw away your DSLRs, and especially in the comment he says later, and you don't need an Android phone either. This is it right
throw
now.
Throw
away your Android phone.
No, your DSLR. Throw away that, really.
Yeah,
in favor of an iPhone.
Yeah.
Good luck with that.
That's a little bold. Until the iPhone
a
can
little
shoot,
bold.
Until,
I'm so being, full of yeah, okay.
That's my British understatement. I'm trying to. Well,
the comments are great. I mean, Scoble says, yeah, I gave away all my Canon cameras. Of course,
I wish
Scoble
I'd been there
that.
When Scoble gave that.
I know.
Because I'm a Canon guy. I mean, look, until the iPhone can shoot in RAW, and has significantly better lenses, et cetera, it's a little extreme. But
Vic then writes, somebody says, indeed, the era has arrived, and Samsung S8 does an even better job than the iPhone. And Vic responds, well, here's the problem. It's Android.
Yeah, but I'm sorry. The Lumia range did better photos than any of these, than either Apple or Android, but it was Windows Phone, so nobody used it. So, I mean, the Lumia phones were fantastic for photos.
Yeah, they were.
But if
remember
you
that
want really
40,
good photos,
it was a 40 megapixel.
Which felt like just showing off at that point.
It was a huge thing. But at the same time, if you want good photos, don't use your phone.
Well, it is the phone.
I got to say, I've got an S8, and we took that phone takes pretty stunning pictures.
I agree.
We also it takes pretty stunning pictures. Yeah, full stop. It really does. It's of all the phones that I've ever had, and I haven't used a camera in a while. But
there you are. You're the example. You don't need a camera. You've got a phone.
I don't. Well,
the best camera is the one you have with you, and and we always have our phones, and so there's a, it's an unambiguous great thing as these phones get better and better and better, the camera phones, and we always have that. But there's, until you can, you just can't swap lenses on the phone. There's things you simply can't do with light. And so people who want to do a wide range of things in photography are simply always going to be on cameras. But I think it is magnificent how great these camera phones are getting. And their ubiquity does mean that all kinds of things are being captured that never would have been in the past.
I think this is a really big societal change. I mean, we first saw it with Rodney King back in the 90s. And now we're seeing
Rodney
it with
King.
Yeah. Well, the whole Rodney King beating was caught.
Oh, on a camera phone.
Because somebody had a low cost video camera.
Yeah.
And they was just like, okay, well, I've got this lying around the house. Oh, well, video that. That's something else. And now everybody's got a video camera on them all the time. Yeah. You can Facebook Live this stuff.
Would we know as much as we do about police shootings of black people if it weren't for camera phones?
I mean, presumably no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, all of.
I mean, Amy, you must have covered this.
Oh, I was going to say, I have a funny story. So I've had two careers. The first career was as a journalist, and I lived in Japan in the mid 90s. And when I moved back to the United States to go to journalism school at Columbia, my phone had a camera in it, and it was one of the first of its kind ever. And the very first class, I had paid my way through Columbia. So like I'd moved back to the United States. I'm sitting in class first day. It was an ethics class. And the question was, should journalists be allowed to use digital cameras?
Oh,
be allowed?
And, right. That was the question. Now, to be fair, this was 2000, right? So it was a while ago.
It wasn't a stunt question. It was an earnest question.
No.
Well, what was the premise? Why not?
This was not too long after the O.J. Simpson dual cover had come out, and Time and Newsweek had run different covers. And one was clearly digitally altered to make him look more menacing.
I remember that.
So the question was, should journalists be allowed to alter their photos? Should they be allowed to use digital cameras because you can alter the photos in that way? And I raised my hand and I said, so I get what kind of conversation we're having here. However, I've just come from a country where people have cameras in their phones, right? And I pull out my phone, which doesn't work in the US, but I pulled it out. I was like, look, there's a camera in this phone. And this phone is also connected to the internet. So theoretically, like, I could publish this photo from my phone to your newspaper's website. And everybody looked at me like it was an alien. And I got dressed down by the professor, who said, mark my word, no news organization would ever, ever publish a photo taken, a grainy photo taken by a phone. And I said, but you're missing the point. It's not the quality of the photo. It's the immediacy. It's the fact that I can publish visual content anywhere I'm at any time. And then I thought, well, great. I've wasted $30,000 going to grad school.
Imagine the professor 13 years later when the Chicago Sun-Times fired every one of its photojournalists and told its reporters, now it's your job to take pictures with your phones. 13 years.
That's right.
That's all it took.
But again, it comes back to change. So we're used to thinking of quality photos. I don't think the iPhone 7 takes the world's greatest pictures. However, part of our sort of reaction, I think, has to do with the idea that we're in our heads, you know, great quality photos only come from these kinds of cameras. And our part of our reaction, I think, is this aversion to change, right? So.
Isn't that, you know, we have taken more pictures last year than in the entire history of humankind.
Yeah. Not all of them are good, but
not all of them survive. But I think it's a good thing. And I think Vic's point was more, I'm going to give him credit, maybe that he doesn't deserve, but I think his point was more that computational photography is changing our notion of what a camera is. That the thing that makes an iPhone great is not its lens, it's not its capturing equipment, it's the massive computer in the iPhone that takes those images and makes something out of them that's so much better than it should be, than it has any right to be. And the Pixel 2 does exactly the same thing. Google's got a whole lot of artificial intelligence built into the software for the camera.
I do think Vic was slightly disingenuous, though, in that there was
a little shot.
There was a definite was a two shot. Fingers to you, Google, in this.
Yeah, it was a little.
It was just
shot.
Like, you passed me over for senior management. Screw you guys, I'm out of here. You know?
Screw you guys.
And he's the good news is he's doing just fine on his own. He's got a great company.
I thought Facebook pulling the plug on Skynet was a really fun rumor while it lasted.
Tell me about
that. Was
that
was such yellow journalism.
Pulling the plug on
Well, it was in the show notes. So basically, but I watched the story as it unfolded. I guess that there was some kind of a chatbot thing going on inside of Facebook, and the sensationalistic and not at all accurate but really cool headline was that these two chatbots had established own language that only they could understand, and it was creepy stuff, actually, if you looked at the sentences that were going back and forth. And Facebook, somebody had this diving save where they grabbed the power cord and pulled it out.
No, I didn't read that part.
Right before Skynet woke up. No, this was kind of like when the tabloids got hold of it. But the first Boy Genius Report article that I saw, the first article I saw was on Boy Genius Report. It was actually the day before my book came out, which has something to do with this.
You have. So you like, have an article.
I have this.
You have a social network. Can I say this?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Called Flutter, because it's very early on in the book.
Yeah, yeah. You
that
see it coming a mile.
Does achieve sentience.
Yes, exactly.
But it turns out not to be exactly malicious.
Well, not deliberately so. So anyway, this thing
comes
out.
It's very funnily so.
Yeah, yeah. But so Facebook, so there was a story was that there was this freak out that Facebook, these bots.
Let me read you. Actually, why don't you and I
was going to say, we
let's do a dramatic reading.
Okay, would you be Alice?
You want to be Alice or Bob?
Oh, you'd be Bob.
Alice has all the best lines.
Okay. This is Bob and Alice are two AIs on the Facebook network. Everything else.
Balls have zero to me, 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 to.
You, I, everything else.
Balls have a ball to me, to me, to me, to me, to me, to me.
And they walked off arm in arm into the sunset.
To me.
Skynet, this ain't, you know.
It is. That would be a frightening thing to see spontaneously coming up on the monitor.
You've never
clear.
Had a drunk text from my wife, have you? But no.
Remember when somebody had a Google Home talking to an Amazon Echo, and it was very similar.
It
to
was
this.
Very charming. I think that was actually pretty well scripted as well. I mean, it was they understood each other a little too well.
Yeah.
But it was fun.
It was clearly scripted because there is no way that actually could have happened unless there was some skill. Taught to both of them.
What you guys just read is the kind of conversation that's going to happen for at least, you know, the foreseeable future.
Well, and I talked about this last week because Elon Musk is panicking about artificial intelligence. And, artificial intelligence researcher at MIT, one of their most famous roboticists, said that's only because Elon knows nothing about AI. And anybody who's worked in the field knows this stuff is not even close to coming, you know. Now, maybe that's disinformation being passed along by the AI community.
We're pretty far off from far off from machines making autonomous big autonomous decisions. However, the foundation is being laid right now. And so if you think about a house being built, right? If the first layer of that foundation is a little off and then you build the next one and the next one, you wind up with a building. It's a building, but it's a cockeyed sort of weird tilting, building that probably wouldn't pass code, right, someday in the future. So, you know, I actually think there's plenty to be worried about, but it has to do with how the corpus is being built, what's happening with the data, and then what decisions we're asking the machines to make. Because at some point, in order for the systems to advance, they have to write their own software. Right. And again, this is a little farther off, but it's within our lifetimes. And then at some point, you know, we lose some of that control and understanding. So I do think that there's a lot for us to be worried about, but it's a lot more subtle, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's concerning for sure.
Yeah. But and this was the point the MIT scientist made. If you're going to make a law now, what are you going to regulate?
Yeah, well, that's the problem, right? This is so much of it comes back to this, and that is, in order for our laws to be enforced and to be applicable, they have to be descriptive. But it's also hard to, because you can't have a law that's so over encompassing and broad, because it'll get struck down and it'll get challenged. People won't know how to enforce it. On the other hand, if it's too specific, it becomes outdated right away. So one of the challenges every democracy on planet Earth is going to have going forward is, how do you maintain some kind of rule in society and some kind of laws that make sense, that are neither too restrictive nor too broad, so that they can govern us going forward, and that they can be, it's hard.
But even then, that's only in one country. There are a lot of AI researchers in a lot of countries around the world who are developing this stuff, and there's no way one law is going to control them all.
Yeah.
And we're so far away from a singularity at the moment, it's a joke. But even so, we've got to start thinking about AI in a serious way. And as you say, if the foundations are faulty, then the whole thing comes tumbling down.
Again, to Elon's credit, I think a lot of what he's talking about is thinking now about AI safety.
He gave
$10 million to the Future of Life Institute, I think it's called.
And there's an AI institute that he did.
Yeah, and so even if it's wildly improbable that something terrible will happen, and unfortunately it's probably not wildly improbable, hopefully it is somewhat improbable, but the consequences are so devastating that it makes enormous sense to be thinking about it right now and to be working about it and laying the right foundations. And I think that's generally Elon's point. Mm. Although he did say something kind of chilling, that meeting with the Governor's Council, which I think is what you're referring to, Leo. He was talking to the governors. He basically indicated, and it was sort of in passing, that he had seen something that we haven't. And it implied that he'd seen something behind the curtains, whether it was at Google or somewhere else, that had really kind of chilled him in recent days or weeks at that point.
Two bots going, you, me,
yeah,
Well, no, I mean, you say that, but at DEF CON this year, there was a presentation from researchers who'd taken Musk's OpenAI framework and had used it to develop malware, which could get past security antivirus engines by doing slow iterations and evolution onto the software, until finally, after 100,000 repetitions, you got up with malware, which could easily slip by a security engine. This stuff is coming, but it's just...
Well, part of the problem
whether or not
is,
we need to be hardwiring electromagnetic shotguns to these computers' foreheads is another matter entirely.
In order to test... So you have to have adversarial versions of the tools, right, in order to test and train them.
Yeah, need the black box.
That's right. So one of the problems is, in order to prevent and protect, prevent problems and protect us in the future, you have to train machines to recognize problems. But in order to train them to recognize problems, you have to teach them the problems, right? So again, like this is why I don't think we need rules and regulations, but we do need some kind of meaningful way to have conversations that translate to more than just news headlines and white papers. We have to have good conversations. And right now there are 7 companies that really do control the fate of AI in our future. One of those companies is Tencent, which is a big Chinese company, which, last week had an AI chatbot start talking smack about the Communist Party.
Yeah.
No way. I missed that.
Yeah. You had mentioned Tay earlier.
Yeah, Microsoft Tay. Yeah. I know that story very well.
Oh, Nazi.
Tencent did almost exactly the same thing. They released a bot, and it was taught to hate communism. And then somebody asked you, well, how do you feel about the Communist Party? It was exactly the same thing.
Yeah. Which is a pretty big deal. But, every one of these companies, several of these companies say that they have open source, they've open sourced their tools and their software, but these are still commercial, they are commercially focused. And in the United States, so this is where things get really weird and interesting and different. So China is pretty far ahead in a lot of ways in its AI research, and it's government funded a lot of it. And the work is being done in academia, and a lot of it is, so there's a big government component, and it's a national effort to push ahead. In the United States, it's commercial. All of, our government is very, very far behind. State, military, DOD, very far behind when it comes to AI. The majority of the funding that's going into it is commercially focused, and we don't have the academic, we have academic, research centers that are working on this. But again, there's a commercial there's a commercial focus rather than it being for the, you know, taking this much longer view, and being done sort of as a big national effort. So that's a problem going forward. Because
really,
we have
you don't think the commercial effort could succeed over the government effort?
Well, the problem is
I think of the Genome Project, where there was a government attempt to decode the genome.
I think, that's
and it was a private effort that ended up.
Craig Venter ended up like coming from behind, and they called it a tie.
Hang on. He ended up coming from behind because he took all the government research and said, "Right, that's done. I'm just going to do the."
It's a nice partnership.
Up front. Yeah, this is a public-private.
But Amy, do you think that China has a lead just because it's a government-funded effort?
It did make things go a little bit faster, but for him to say, oh, I decoded the human genome, a lot of other work went into it.
Oh, you have an opinion on this matter, I could tell.
Craig was, he was so self-congratulatory about it, just like,
He tried to patent it, which was perhaps...
the hundreds of millions governments have put into this.
Step goes, too far.
Actually, I got there first, and I'm going to patent it and take all that money, and
I own the genome.
Shameful.
So, Amy, do you think China has an advantage, though, because it's government-funded?
Well, it depends on your perspective. So I think that when it comes to, the war of the future is going to be fought by software, not by hardware, right? The hardware will carry out the software, but it's the software and the data that's going to be making, to be fair, like this is top of mind because I was in Japan for the past couple of weeks and I was there when North Korea sent its latest ICBM.
Yeah.
Not that we were worried about it, but I was thinking a lot about it. And the United States just doesn't have, we don't have that same coordinated effort. And so I'm a capitalist, so I've got nothing against big companies, pushing ahead and for commercial purposes, pushing into AI. The challenge, the problem that I've got is that as a nation, I just don't see us, pushing in a coordinated way ahead, taking a much longer view. And so the AI that's going to get developed, and again, the AI that this is about decision making. We are asking the premise of AI. The premise of AI, if you really go back, all of the early systems were built on games. So checkers, chess, Go, right? And now there's another game that we're training. From the beginning, we have trained these systems to beat us, right? That's that and
well, what do you want him to do? Train him to lose?
My point is, at some point, we are
sometimes
asking
the only way to win
to
is
make,
not to play.
We're asking them to make decisions, and not that I have any more trust in our government than I do in Google. However, I like the idea of public money and public research being used on behalf of all of humanity going forward.
I think just culturally, China has an advantage because it thinks in a much longer time frame, 100-year time frame.
Huge.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
One of the things that worries me about commercial AI projects as well is that there's such a lot of hype talked about it. I mean, Facebook has been banging on about its AI chatbots for over a year now. And then when you actually talk to them about it,
it's not really
AI because there's
Eliza.
A human behind it.
This is like Eliza. Yeah. We have not made any progress since...
This is massive,
Eliza
massive
written in BASIC for an Apple II. Yeah. That's exactly what these guys sound like.
Well, until the Tencent AI started denouncing the Communist Party, that's kind of cool. That's very
Eliza couldn't
Eliza.
Do that.
Eliza couldn't denounce
the
Communist Party to save her life.
Yeah.
But when we think about AI, we anthropomorphize it, right? So the real promise of AI isn't the human form that it takes.
Right.
It's the automation of all the crap that we don't want to deal with or do, right? And that has tentacles into all different areas of our life. Goldman's figured out a way to automate 3/4 of its IPO process, right? There are all these different steps involved, and they figured that out through machine learning. So, I think this is one of those things where, again, we don't realize the great opportunities that we created and the way that we maybe seeded our future with some things we don't like until it gets here and we realize that we're sorted into different castes and suddenly we don't have opportunities that we think we should have real life is very much an uncanny valley, right?
Do you see 21st century Luddites taking over on this front?
I don't know. I don't think so. And that's because... we humans want to use as little energy as possible, right?
I know I do.
I know I do too. Most people do. We're programmed that way, right? So how realistic is it that you're going to go back to writing letters and sending, right, you know, letters and just, you know, it's not realistic. So I think that there's a lot more to be concerned with. It's just not very interesting stuff. It's not as interesting or as exciting as, like, you know, autonomous weapons.
I also feel like it's very difficult to, I would agree with you, but I'm not sure it's easy to figure out what to think about or how to think about it. I don't know if, you know, I guess we should spend time doing it. And Elon's funded many efforts to do that. And I don't fault him for that.
And there's some very rigorous thinking that's going on in that domain. I mean,
yeah, you really wonder, though, how useful it's going to be.
Well, we hope it's very useful, right? Because the number of scenarios in which things could go spinning out of control, the list is long. And a lot of these scenarios, as they kind of get war-gamed, are about a lot of people, about smart people doing the wrong thing for the right reasons.
Right.
And unless you think through second and third and fourth order effects, terrible unintended consequences could ensue as you start designing something that can improve itself and improve itself at a compounding exponential rate that's much more like the pace of Moore's law than the pace of evolution. Yeah. And so I think that, you know, wargaming these things now and having very, very careful thought applied to it, it may not be the perfect machine or it may not be the perfect weapon. I can't think what else we can do right now, you know? And I do think it's an important exercise. Nicholas Bostrom's book is now a little bit old. It's been about 3 years since it came out. But it probably paints the most detailed sets of scenarios of what could go wrong. And I do think that that has kind of been like the intellectual framework for a lot of the AI safety work that's going on right now. It's called superintelligence.
Yeah, we interviewed Nick when
that
came out. Yeah,
right. Yeah, very sharp guy.
We've spent a lot of time on triangulation talking to various factions in this, and there's a lot of debate about it.
Yeah,
I don't think there's anything wrong with thinking about it. I think it's everything right with thinking about it.
No, I think we've got to lay the grounds for this because we're going to look at, just from a societal perspective, just with the technology that we have at the moment, you're looking at massive employment problems coming down the line 5, 10, 15 years when we get computers to do things like driving or deliveries.
We're heading straight for that future. I understand that. I just don't know if there's much we could do about it.
Well,
it's good
we work out the social systems now that we can deal with it.
Oh, you know what's going to happen.
Well,
There are two ways. We're not going to do anything. It's but like the climate crisis.
Yeah.
We're just going to mess around, debate over it, and then not going to do anything until it hits us overhead, and then it'll be too late.
Yeah, but we've gone through this before with industrialization. We've gone through it.
Yeah, we planned for that very well.
To an extent with literacy. Yeah, and we didn't plan for either of them. But we've got 7 billion people on the planet right now. You know, and everything is interconnected in such an extent that if society does break down, you're looking at megadeaths.
I know.
So we need to sort this out now.
I just don't feel too sanguine about our ability to plan for this future.
I like
you're
to think
such
humans
a fatalist.
I am a fatalist, but look, I feel like certainly our government is in a different dimension, a different world, and from the world that we're living in, and anything that they plan to do about anything is irrelevant, because they're almost it's an impedance mismatch. They're operating at a different time scale than we are.
I know. Just go to the DMV.
DMV. It's
a terrible branding event for government. Yeah. Every time a citizen walks into the DMV, it is just a
catastrophic branding event.
Yes, and
are we going to solve AI?
Yeah,
don't have enough people who have any kind of science or technology background that go into politics.
Yeah.
We at some point years ago had an office called the Office of Technology Assessment, and it was staffed who were not political, and it was a teaching exercise. Their job was to go and meet with members of Congress and help them get educated. Gingrich defunded that in the 90s. However, that office became the gold standard around the world. So a bunch of other countries have that office. We don't. And so now, in the absence of the OTA, and you know, with so much change coming so quickly, all technology gets politicized. You know, and very few people really understand what it is or how it works. So the U.S. does not have a national biology policy, and yet we're standing on the precipice of CRISPR and, you know, editing embryos, and we don't have a national AI policy. We don't have people who are elected who even understand what AI is, even though they're talking about technological, unemployment and displacement.
I think that's all true. And I'm not sure that that's the worst possible outcome. I think a worse outcome would be a government that thinks it knows what's going to happen in
the
future.
Yeah, look at the Stalinist model.
And has a plan for the future. I think that could be worse. In some ways, I think it's better. Maybe I'm a little more laissez-faire. That they just, go ahead and worry about transgender bathrooms and let technology happen, and we'll see what happens.
And there are, I'll say, there are some really talented technologists, thank God, who are giving back and getting involved in public life. So there is something.
Well, we have Brianna Wu on the show. She's running for Congress in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's certainly technologically
we're
literate.
Also, there's something called the United States Digital Service, who I'm
we've
sure
had Matt Cutts on Wednesday.
I was about to mention Matt, precisely. Yep. Oh, you yep. just had him on Wednesday.
Yeah.
I was just about to mention Matt.
He's the acting director.
Yes.
Former Googler. By the way, I asked him, you're still doing stuff? He said, yeah, even in the Trump administration? Yeah. You've not been defunded? No.
Yeah. No, he re-upped. He was wondering whether or not there was going to be a place for him after the administration changed, but he is still there, and he's doing incredible work. I think he's one of the first 50 people at Google. I know he was mad at google.com, which I thought was a really cool email address. So that you got to be have your first name at Google. You were there mighty early. So there are some folks that are out there.
But there's a bunch who aren't. The OSTP is basically bled dry of
Isn't
people too.
Yeah, that's so sad.
So, I don't. And again, I don't want anybody to walk away with the idea that I think that the government should be in charge of everything. I don't think that at all. And I am not myself political. I'm not Democrat or Republican. I'm independent. However, I want people who are making decisions on behalf of our collective future to be informed. I don't care what party they belong to, as long as they believe in science and data, and they're not politicizing technology to the point where our laws don't make any sense anymore.
It would be nice
to that end. Yeah, I mean, and it's our country, it's England, this is true of democracies all over the world. We're all facing the same problem right now.
Oh, no, I mean, in the case of the country of my birth, we've had Amber Rudd over here this week chatting to Silicon Valley people, and she's got this fantastic idea. Well, we're just going to have to mandate back doors, and it's up to you guys to
figure it out.
Encryption.
You figure it out.
You're the whiz kids. And you're like, okay. It's math. It doesn't really, there's not a lot of wiggle room.
I love
there.
Malcolm Turnbull, the Prime Minister of Australia, who said the laws of Australia supersede the laws of mathematics.
I hope he said that as a joke.
No, he was actually serious.
The laws of Australia supersede the laws of nature.
Supersede the laws
I'll
of
find
mathematics.
It for you, Amy.
Now, if that's the case, well, why not just take a walk out that window and see how you do against the laws of gravity?
Yeah.
Because, these things are immutable. And until we find new ways of doing it, then,
Here's the story from the Telegraph. Malcolm Turnbull says, well, I'll get the quote here. This is back down to encrypted messages once again.
Mm-hmm. Which was Amber Rudd's issue, right?
Yeah.
That's what she was talking about.
On challenge on whether it's possible to fully crack down on encryption, saying the laws of Australia, quote, the laws of Australia prevail in Australia. I can assure you of that. The laws of mathematics are very commendable, but the only law that applies in Australia is the law of Australia.
Well, they have.
Actually, it's not strictly true.
They have done a very good job of evading the laws of gravity.
Of physics.
On the bottom side of the planet there. So maybe.
Let's take a
when
break.
When you look at the globe.
Oh, God, the stupid.
I actually have,
burns.
I have at great expense, imported a member of the iGen. She is here. We're going to talk in just a second to Piper Reese. She is very famous. I'm going to put you on, Piper. I know this is a surprise, but we want to talk about your generation and how screwed up it is, if you don't mind, okay?
blame your phone.
She started on YouTube as a YouTuber when you were 7, right? 10 years ago. She's 17 now. She's up here interviewing to go to Stanford. And I thought, well, here's a perfect example of somebody who grew up in the iPhone era. And let's find out if the iGen really is all that screwed up. Okay, not yet. We're going to do a commercial break. We'll figure out how to mic Amber, and she can find a place at the table or something like that. Just a brief one, Piper. Not a long one. No, Amber Rudd is not here. I got confused for a second.
It's going to suck.
Our show.
Well, in some ways, she probably couldn't even open the door. She's that clueless.
The laws of Australia supersede the laws of mathematics.
And gravity.
And gravity.
And gravity.
So you should just push him out of an airplane, see what happens. Mm-hmm. No, I shouldn't say that because that's probably against the laws of Australia.
Yeah, it's going to get you arrested.
I hope you've seen the Sydney Opera House already. I wouldn't go there now.
No. I love you, Malcolm. You're great.
They'll peg you out in the outback and put drop bears on you until you die.
I love Australia. I do. And I love the laws of mathematics. So somehow I have to make those work together. Our show today brought to you by Casper, the online retailer of fabulous mattresses at a fraction of the price, because everyone deserves a good night's sleep. The Casper mattress was designed by 20 engineers, perfected by a community of 500,000 sleepers. It is now the mattress for you. But you may say, but Leo, how do I know that? I want to go lie on it before I buy it. You can't. You have to buy it first. But here's the beauty part. You can lie on it for 100 nights, and if at any time you do not agree with me, this is the best mattress you have ever had, you call Casper, they'll give you a full refund, they'll come, they'll take the mattress, that's that. So in effect, you get 100 nights to try before you buy. Casper is amazing. They've combined pressure-relieving, supportive memory foam with a breathable open-cell layer for all-night comfort. Time magazine said one of the best 25 inventions of 2015. Fast Company said one of the most innovative companies of 2017, Big Innovation Award 2016, because it's a great mattress. I sleep on a Casper. I love it. Fast Company probably sleeps on it, too. That's why they call it the most innovative brand of 2017. Casper mattresses are delivered to your door in a surprisingly compact box. It's very easy. I sent one to my son in college, and they just bring it upstairs. Free shipping and returns to the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. now, by the way, Ian.
Mm-hmm.
Considering you spend about, a third of your life on a mattress, it's important you truly sleep on it before committing. That's why Casper gives you 100 nights to try out the best mattress ever. And by the way, on these hot summer nights, you'll be glad the Casper breathes. It sleeps cool. That's really important. And I don't know how they do it. I've had other mattresses where you have to let them air out for a month. Not the Casper. Out of the box. Fresh as a daisy. Wonderful. It is a fabulous night's sleep. Get $50 towards your mattress purchase at casper.com/twit. Promo code twit. casper.com/twit. Use the promo code twit. Terms and conditions apply. $50 off at casper.com/twit. How can we get Piper? Would you mind letting her? You can lean over my shoulder, share my mic. Do you mind, Piper?
No.
So did you see this article? Come on and have a seat here. Piper Reese is here. Piper's Picks on YouTube. Congratulations on your success on YouTube.
Thank you so much.
You've been doing this for 10 years?
Yeah, since I was 7.
That's incredible. There she is as a 7-year-old. You've interviewed all the biggest names in Hollywood.
Yep.
You're the iPhone generation, the YouTube generation. Did you read this article? Probably not, because you guys don't read.
No, we don't. We only read BuzzFeed. So.
Well, this is not BuzzFeed. This is The Atlantic. Have smartphones destroyed a generation. So here's the, and you tell me what you think. Obviously, you're not one of these people, but no one's saying that everybody that grew up with the iPhone, and the iPhone came out in 2007 when you were 7. So,
right?
This is your whole life. Have you had an iPhone your whole life?
No, I haven't. I actually was not allowed to have a phone till 8th grade.
Oh my God. How did you live?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It was
weird.
Do
you use Snapchat now?
Yes, I do. I mean, I have the Piper's Pick Snapchat that I do.
Yeah, see, it's a little different. You're creating content for your peers. Is this your dad?
Yes.
Smart man. You didn't let her use an iPhone that kept... So here's the stats that are in this article. I just want to know what you think of it. A smartphone generation. So after the iPhone came out, that's that bar right here. Okay. The amount of time teenagers spent out without their parents, just with their friends, plummeted. 8th graders are pink. 10th graders are green, 12th graders a little higher. Those are, but you see it's falling dramatically, especially with the younger generation. Do you hang out with your friends?
I do. That's
you go to the mall with your friends?
Yeah, I do go to the mall with my friends a lot. I think that specifically is really interesting to me because, like, in my case, it's just because I can't get out a lot. Like, I don't have a car yet. So,
this is the other one. Okay. Percentage of 12th graders who drive.
That makes sense.
Plummeted.
Yeah.
Do you have a driver's license?
I mean, no, not yet. Mm-hmm. I am about to try for my permit. So when you said the DMV thing, that was interesting to me.
But my daughter's here. She's 25. When she was 15 and a half, She said, I'm going to DMV. I'm getting the driver's license. She cried when she failed the test first time. I'm sorry, but you really were excited about driving. My son was just a couple of years older. He didn't get his license till he was 18. He's 22. So I think that this is true, right? This falling.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me because I feel like we can talk to our friends over the phone or we can text our friends.
Ah.
So the rush to drive isn't as much. And then also with phones, that is when Uber started and things like that. So the question is, do we really need to be able to drive when I can just be like, oh, I'll get an Uber here in 5 minutes?
But also, do you need to be physically present in order to get
on the mic here. Oh, that one's not on. Can you turn that on? We gave him a mic. Look at that. Isn't that nice? There it is. Go ahead.
Well, so, I mean, you don't need to be physically present with your friends anymore because you can chat with them online. Or do you get the same thing out of chatting online with friends as you do with meeting physically?
I mean, in a way, yes. Like, my friends and I text a lot. I mean, we use FaceTime sometimes, stuff like that. But for me personally, I like being with people.
Oh, you're so weird.
I'm sorry. Things are really busy now.
You're probably not a good... Dating, again, the line goes down.
Wait, dating went down. That's interesting.
Dating... Well, but Abby, you dated as a teenager, but Henry was always going out with a group of friends, right? And it was much more of a kind of a hookup scene than it was like a dating scene.
Like that now, too.
It is, isn't it? I'll skip the sex part. I don't want to embarrass you. More likely to feel lonely.
Dad's sitting just there.
Yeah, I don't want to embarrass your dad. This percentage of 8th, 10th, and 12th graders who agree with or mostly agree with the statement, I often feel left out of things and a lot of time I feel lonely. Look how that's gone straight up.
Okay, the Snapchat map totally made that so much worse because I know a lot of my friends are talking about like, oh, I can see when my friends are hanging out without me now. So people are going to feel even more lonely. Or when people are posting with one friend on Instagram, then you see, oh, my friend hung out with that person and didn't invite me.
Oh, so you,
a lot of that.
This is true for adults too. A lot of social media is depressing.
Yeah.
Like there's the FOMO, the fear of missing out.
Yeah. Well, there have been psychological studies about this because when people post on social media,
they only post
generally
the
good stuff. Exactly. They don't say, woke up with a hangover, I'm feeling like death, my girlfriend's just had a massive argument with me. You know, you don't want to put that stuff online, but it's just like, had a great day at work, you know?
Okay, yes, but a lot of teenagers have accounts that adults don't necessarily see so much that are more of the private accounts that have stuff that is more depressing, so they can vent and get it out that people haven't seen as much. So that does exist. And that
did you watch that? What is it? 12 Reasons Why?
13 Reasons Why. Yeah. I started it, then I wasn't allowed to watch it because of all the reviews on it, which I understand. Like, I get
it's about a young girl who ends up committing suicide. It's about teenage suicide.
And I think that triggered a lot for a lot of people, and it obviously has caused some really bad things. And I think with that, I don't think it was as much as causing it. I think it was people relating to it and saying, oh, if she tried it, maybe I should try it too.
Do you get enough sleep?
No, not at all. Because, I mean...
I don't know any teenager who gets enough sleep, though. Let's be fair. Never.
You're supposed to get 9 to 10 hours. Yeah, like, that's not going to happen.
So here's the graph, though. Look at this. And one of the theories is that teenagers take their phone to... Do you take your phone to bed with you?
Always.
Yeah.
I am on my phone till 4 a.m.
We have to take our 14-year-old's phone away because he will stay up almost all night talking to friends, chatting, playing games.
Yeah, don't give my dad that idea.
Do you actually
I think he
talk?
Just did.
What do you do, Piper? Do you talk?
Okay, it depends on who I'm talking to or, I mean, even texting because it really depends on the person. I mean, I prefer to be talking to someone on the phone if I have enough to talk about, but if it's been a really boring day and I have nothing to discuss, I'll text so I have more time to think of stuff. That's also probably part of it with dating is it's easier to text a guy than it is to call a guy. So if you have that option, you have more time to think and you don't have to be nervous and on your feet, which is probably why dating's gone down.
Wow.
Ooh.
You know, if you don't date in person, it's not going to go well in the future.
Yeah.
You got to at some point.
That might take a while for people to realize. Yeah. It's just easier.
I think you probably are not a great example. You're obviously very well spoken, outgoing, and you have a YouTube channel. There's a thing in Snapchat that I didn't know about where you go for a streak, like how many days you've posted.
Snap streaks.
Right.
Do you pay attention to that? Your friends pay attention to that?
I mean, I think my friends pay attention to it. I don't really do it because I'm not really going to do that on my Piper's Pick stuff. Just be like, oh, yeah, I'm going to streak Piper's Pick stuff.
Because you post every day, I bet.
I mean, I think we post most days. We've kind of switched over to Instagram stories for the most part.
Oh, there's another problem.
Yeah.
Oh, we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I thought if we're going to... How old are you? And that's so cute. Is that you?
Oh, God. Yeah. I mean, that's actually not that old. I just
Looks like it's last year.
I changed my hair a lot this year, so that's what happens. Really old.
You're growing up, Piper. Aw. Piper, thank you for joining us. Piperspicks.tv. And we're going to talk after the show, right?
Yeah,
all
thank
right.
you.
And how'd it go at Stanford? Did you have fun?
Yeah, it was a really awesome campus.
Yeah, it's very nice. Yeah.
It's the bomb.
It's the bomb. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Piper Reese.
Thank you.
Amy, did you want to ask Piper any questions as long as I got her here? This is your future. You know, this happens in just a few years.
I know. I have a 7-year-old.
It's this far away.
So I'm mostly just shock. It's all shock. Yeah.
But no, wouldn't you be proud to have Piper as a dog? I mean, Piper's very impressive, right? Smart, outgoing. There's nothing wrong with this generation, at all. And that's, I think, maybe a larger point. Thank you, Piper.
Thank you.
You may sit back down, Mr. Thompson. Thank you for letting us talk to Piper Reese.
I thought it was Gen Alpha. Didn't we circle back?
Nope, too late.
I like iGen.
I think that's a very good name.
Gen Z has been used a fair amount. There's going to be a brawl between iGen and Gen Z, I have a feeling. And just
Gen
because
Z. I feel like iGen is a name that was created by baby boomers.
Yeah, it was created and also it was created
as a sort of
it's been trademarked,
yeah.
So I don't know if people are going to be down with that.
But it's named after the iPhone, and the premise is...
I feel like the generation should be able to allow... We should have the luxury of naming ourselves.
Well, you're not in it, so you don't get to.
No, okay, I'm Piper. Gen Y. I'm part of that, in between nobody cared about us.
You have a sucky generation. I just want to say, your generation sucks. I was a baby boomer, my friend.
Gen Y and millennials.
That was the greatest generation after the last
No, week. We're not Post. Millennials.
Oh, is there a difference between... Sorry to be so ignorant. So
millennials came of age at the turn of the century. Gen Y is a little older than that.
And then
there was Gen X, because you succeeded Gen X.
Gen X is basically 1964 to 1980, if you were born in those.
I was born in 56, which is the very tail end of the baby boomers. I'm the me generation, baby.
I was right
it's
at the start of
me.
The Gen X's.
That's
so,
Gen X.
You know,
all about me.
And it was a great book, don't get me wrong, but I'm not building my entire persona around it.
Well, you realize is before it was a book, it was a band. It was Billy Idol's. It was Billy Idol's band before.
It was a band called Gen X.
Yeah, it was called Generation X.
Wow.
It was Billy Idol's first band before he became. Well, I guess he went by Billy Idol in those days as well, but he made much bigger deal in his solo career. But yeah, their first band was called Generation X.
Speaking of Billy Idol, did you hear about his performance at the Salesforce conference?
I did not.
God,
that is just the kind of place I'd expect him to perform.
Oh no, he performed at the Salesforce conference, and no word of a lie, he changed the White Wedding lyrics to "It's a nice day for CRM."
Oh,
and it's like that's it. Get out. You know, I don't care how good your music was. That's just wrong.
Billy was never really edgy. It was all an act.
He was
the Gary Glitter of his generation. Well,
please don't. No, don't go there. Don't go there.
The Gary Glitter jokes are really Great Britain. They're just it's too soon.
It's too soon
for Gary Glitter jokes.
As long as we've dissed one generation, let's diss another generation. My daughter's generation. This is not The Onion, The Wall Street Journal. Millennials unearth an amazing hack to get free TV. The antenna. Is this legal? This is The Wall Street Journal. They interviewed Dan Cisco, who's 28 years old.
And a major dumbass from the looks
of it. He said, I was just kind of surprised this technology exists. He's talking about an antenna. It's been awesome. It doesn't log out and it doesn't skip.
I weep for our future generations.
I really weep for the Wall Street Journal. This is just...
Oh, come on. It was a great
article to write. It was a great story.
I'm sorry. As a journalist, you couldn't look at... You couldn't interview someone like that and not write about it.
We're piling on millennials. We picked some doofus, the worst example of his generation, and say, look, they're discovering antennas.
Yeah.
I'll tell you where antennas are big. Japan. They've got cars all have television monitor...
Wait a minute.
Video inside the car.
They have antennas on TV. They have rabbit ears on their cars?
No, they've got digital antennas on their cars, and anybody who wants to can get live television while you're driving. It's in the car.
Which is great for driver safety.
Yes.
Because you can always pull up those, kind of top tips on how to avoid an accident right before you're about to get into one.
Yeah, on the other hand, though, which is worse for driver safety? Having two kids going at it hammer and tongs with fists out in the back seat, or just sticking them in front of the Google box and just wait and letting them just chill out in front of
definitely the latter. I'm worried about driver distraction when
yes. They quote Scott Wills, who is a person of my era. And a wireless industry executive. He worked for years that set the transition from analog to digital in motion over TV.
Which took forever.
Took forever. Yeah. And finally, about, 8 years ago, all the televisions, most of the television stations went digital, which was a good thing all around, I think. He wondered, though. He thought that the millennials might be a little confused by this. So he asked his son, do you think there's broadcast anymore? His son said, Dad, you should know better than anyone. There's no broadcast TV. Broadcast TV's gone. He's 24. I had no idea, he said, of broadcast continued existence. I'm still not even familiar with the concept. I'm telling you, I think this is just bad journalism where you find a couple of really stupid people in your generation. See, what I did, the opposite. I found a smart representative of the iGen.
Mm-hmm.
Showed you those. There's nothing to fear. Hey, we had a great week on Twit. Let me show you a little example of some of the fun we had. Roll the film.
Previously on Twit.
So that's it for iPad today. We didn't say why we're wearing hats today. But I don't think. What?
It's iOS today now.
That's it for iOS today.
It is too early.
I'm Leo Laporte. That's Sarah Lane. And we thank you all for
the new screensavers.
Horizons, you are go for departure.
Mr. Delahanty, take us out.
What speed?
This is the nerdiest thing ever.
This is elite.
What's the NSS Laporte?
NSS Laporte on screen.
Ray shields.
Should I demand them to surrender?
Yes.
Shall I divert power to the weapons, Captain?
Setting red alerts. Fire everything we've got at them. Looks like we have impact.
I think I broke the...
This is what happens when you take down NSS Laporte.
This week in Google.
I thought, I'm reading The Onion. But it wasn't The Onion, it was The Wall Street Journal. Millennials unearth an amazing hack to get free TV. The antenna. I was just kind of surprised that this technology exists, says Mr. Cisco, 28 years old. It doesn't log out, and it doesn't skip.
You're doomed. I just want to give them a dial telephone and see what they do with it.
Twit, now in color.
Life support's down 41%.
Keep firing, Tactical.
I'm doing the best I can.
You could do a little bit better.
We're going to roast these pirates.
Yeah. That is the nerdiest thing we have ever. What is the name of that game so we can... It's Horizons? Starship Horizons. StarshipHorizons.com? Something like that.
Is it like a Star Trek ripoff or something?
No, not every starship comes from Star Trek.
No, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Okay,
we saw that well before.
So you're on the cap. You're the bridge of a starship, okay. And each of you has to take a turn. You have one server, a local server, running the game, and then everybody logs in via a browser, so you can use a phone or an iPad. It's actually a pretty cool game. The whole show is the new screensavers from yesterday. You can watch the whole thing. Our show today, in fact, everything you see today, brought to you by our internet service provider. I want to give Sonic a huge plug. Our 10 gigabit fiber line up and down comes from the best internet service provider in the country. Look at the deal you get. You can go to sonic.com/twit. There's the address form. You can fill it out. Look at the deal you get. One of my friends actually was bemoaning. We went over the Comcast terabyte band. And they asked, how do I get out of the terabyte bandwidth cap? How do I get out of this? And they said, well, you have to get business class. And he called business. And they said, well, we can't have, it's two different divisions. He said, should I go Sonic? I said, yes. Mm-hmm. Look what you get. You get fiber for home. I won't tell you the price till the end, although you can see it on the screen. You get 15 email accounts. You get a gigabyte of storage. You get personal web hosting. You get a domain name, custom domain name. You get fax line service, phone service with unlimited local and long distance. You get a gigabit down, and all of this, $40 a month. And you could switch from your current carrier, and you could port your phone number over. So the phone service is just like your old phone service, but it's all total, flat fee, $40 a month. And here's the other thing. By standing up for privacy, Sonic will fight. They fight. Look at their EFF scorecard. Green checks across the board. They stand up for their customers. They fight government subpoenas. They have no bandwidth caps, zero bandwidth caps. Use all you want. They'll make more. And, of course, great local customer support. Sonic.com/twit. Join the internet revolution. Get your first month of Sonic internet and phone service free when you go to sonic.com/twit. Bundle it with Dish and you'll save $120 on your Sonic bill.
And if you can't get it, I'm sorry. I feel bad for you. Sonic, but if you can, there's no reason. No reason to stay with those other guys. Sonic.com/twit. You know, I forgot to do, and I know Karsten knows I forgot to do this. I forgot to ask Jason Howell what's coming up this week. Jason?
This week, on Tuesday, August 8th, Sharp is set to unveil the Aquos S2. It's a smartphone with a 5.5-inch display and a tri-bezel-less design.
Whoa.
With an 85% screen-to-body ratio. They're all doing that right now. It's also rumored to have an on-screen fingerprint sensor. Should be interesting. On Thursday, August 10th, Motorola will release its latest flagship phone, the Moto Z2 Force, with a shatterproof screen, dual rear-facing cameras, and a design that facilitates Motorola's modular extensions that they call Moto Mods, including, by the way, a new 360-degree camera Moto Mod that will be released concurrently. Also on the 10th, Snap will release its second earnings report to date, and it's not expected to be all that great. Snapchat has seen an escalation of feature parity among its biggest competitors, and that has been part of what has resulted in the value of Snap stock hitting its lowest points since its IPO at the beginning of the year. That's a look at a few of the things we'll be tracking in the coming week. Join Megan Maroney and me on Tech News Today every weekday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, here on twit.tv.
Thank you, Jason Howell. You heard Piper say it, I think. Everybody's going to Instagram. They're leaving Snapchat behind.
Stampede.
Yeah. I don't get it. I try to do those Instagram or look at those Instagram stories. I don't understand who's doing that and why. Who's... I'm just old.
I spend all my time on Vine.
Vine, at least it had this thing. It was 6 seconds. It was kind of fun. But the Instagram stories, I see people I know spending lots of time. And like I'm watching Justine. She's like doing something, but obviously not paying any attention to any of her friends or anything else because she's constantly making her. Do you do that? I bet you do that, Piper. You're constantly making your story. And then I'd love to see the stats. Who's looking at those stories? Really? Do you look at Instagram stories? No.
I don't even have an Instagram account. I feel quite out of it.
How about you, Amy? Am I wrong?
No, I don't. I don't. All right. But I use Snap.
You do?
I do.
Is that how you communicate with your 7-year-old?
Yeah, that's exactly how.
We parents, we need something.
It's hard to believe. Yeah. It was reported that last year Google nearly paid $30 billion for Snap.
That I thought was interesting.
Like, yeah, you're like...
Snap has some really good patents that have to do with visual object recognition. And so that Snap, as it exists today, I don't see lasting in perpetuity, but some of the research that they've done in augmented reality and visual object recognition, and there's some interesting things happening behind the scenes.
Wow. Yeah, there's an opportunity.
It's a pity that so much of their stuff is being hijacked by Facebook and others, but... That said, if I never see another one of those dog filters over somebody's faces, I will be a happy man because those are freaky as all hell.
It does show you, though, that any business that's relying on millennials and younger for their business model not being fickle is doomed. Mm-hmm. Why would you invest in any company that, well, because they're hot with the kids right now? Yeah, but that's like the lifespan of a mayfly. I mean, that could change at any second.
And
it's easy to steal their features.
You see, we used to see that with social networks. I mean, remember when Friendster came out in sort of the 90s?
Then Jonathan Abrams is a friend. He's been on our show many times.
And then it was MySpace, and then Facebook got critical mass, and it's difficult to see another social network actually taking over from that.
That's a good point. You could duplicate Facebook's functionality, but there's no way you could steal its network effect.
You've got to have the
social graph.
It's the Metcalf effect. You've got to have that number of interconnected people.
And when you were talking about Snapchat failing to take $30 billion from Google, I was thinking there was one even worse decision not to take Google's money, which was Friendster's. Because Jonathan or Friendster, his board, were offered... I think it was $50 or $60 million.
A lot of money in those days.
IPO Google stock. That's the thing. Uh-huh. So it's gone up. And, you know, what Friendster ultimately was worth, I believe, was zero. I mean, they might have been sold for parts or something like that. So, yes, it was pre-IPO Google stock, which went up many dozens of fold. That was a bummer.
I know of a PR agency that when Microsoft came to their country, Microsoft offered them stock in exchange rather than fees, and they said, no, we'll take the money, thanks.
And that was pre-IPO?
Yeah, that was pre-IPO, and you're just like, wow, you could have retired at the end, in 10 years down the line. But
you know, we all make these decisions.
We all do.
Yes. I advised a friend not to bother investing in Google when it went IPO because there'd be another better search engine along in a minute.
Yeah, Google was relying on 10th mover advantage being the charm, and that actually worked in search engines.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we don't talk. My friend and I don't talk that much now. But
DJI, I didn't know that DJI, the makers of the DJI Phantom, probably the number one, you know, sub $20,000 drone. I didn't know that DJI stands for Dajiang Innovation Corporation. It's a Chinese company. Maybe the Department of Justice didn't know because they've just issued a memo, the Department of the Army, saying, guys, don't use DJI drones anymore. They are the most widely used non-program of record commercial off-the-shelf UAS employed by the Army. But, as you see in this memo, in item 3, cease all use, uninstall all DJI applications, remove all batteries and storage media from device, and secure equipment for follow-on direction. We'll be sending RoboCop to destroy it imminently.
Follow direction. Here's a sledgehammer.
So, DJI, by the way, says, we're surprised and disappointed they didn't contact us. We could have probably reassured them because we're made in China. Everything on this desk is made in China. I understand. Remember when the Department of Commerce a couple of years ago said, don't buy Huawei and ZTE phones because the Chinese military is a part owner. Amy, you're an expert on China. Is this paranoia or is this sensible?
I wouldn't call myself a China expert.
I just told you once, however, so you get to be. So.
I did, however, fly my DJI Maverick this morning. I clearly wasn't obeying the rules.
Well, it's just the Army. You're not in the Army yet.
Yeah,
so it's okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think it depends on where you are. Listen, I have the connected headset.
Yeah.
So you have bird's eye view, and I had a lovely time flying around the bay this morning.
Fun. Oh, you're using like the virtual reality.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. The Maverick has a gimbal camera, and you can control the gimbal by moving your head around. So it's pretty slick. That's
so you feel like you're there, like you're a bird.
Yeah, it's bird's eye view. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Oh. My husband and you, technically, you can fly it and do that at the same time, but I'm not that dexterous, so I usually have somebody else fly if I want to look, and vice versa. Listen, I don't know. You know, if you think about the information that could be scraped. I don't know how much necessarily. Yeah, that's it. It's affordable. You can fly it into a tree.
I need that, by the way, because I have not yet successfully flown.
I have obliterated many drones.
Yeah, me too.
To many things.
And I keep thinking, maybe it's because I have a cheap one, so I buy a more expensive one, fly it into a tree.
Yeah, that'll help.
Maybe that one was too cheap, so I'll buy a more
cheaper
expensive.
Trees, Leo.
Yeah.
You need cheap. They'll just go
I've just given up on drones.
Yeah.
I think the theory is that it could be mapping. Like, they've got GPS, they've got cameras, they've got...
It could be sending data back to China, but this strikes me as Kaspersky all over again. It's just like, they're not proper American homegrown, let's ban them.
But good luck finding a drone that's not made in China.
Exactly.
Yeah, even 3D robotics, when they were making, they were being made largely in China. Right. They had some in Tijuana, too.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's just there is no technology that any of us owns that has at some point hasn't had some interaction with China. So, you know, in terms of mapping, you know, anywhere that you would want to that a Chinese government may get excited about, you know, you're gonna have a hard time flying over anyways. So because there's restricted airspace and it's hard to get to, and to be honest, there's you know, within 2 years there are fleets of CubeSats and MicroSats that are being launched by companies that will be collecting real time hourly maps and data all around planet Earth. So to harness me to get a snapshot on this particular day of the place where I happen to be flying just seems like something that wouldn't be worth their while.
Also, if there is something to be worried about, shouldn't instead of just banning it from U.S. military use, and if there's something that really is, I was going to tell the people who are buying the things. You know, it's like, why shouldn't you be buying this?
Cyber criminals have decided that Hollywood is ripe for the plucking, and the latest victim, HBO recently experienced
a cyber incident.
We got pwned.
Which resulted in the compromise of proprietary information. 1.5 terabytes of data, according to the hackers, were including, oh dear, upcoming episodes of Ballers.
Mm-hmm. And Room 104.
I don't even know. I know what Ballers is because it's on after Game of Thrones. What the hell's Room 104?
It's on after Room 103. That's all I know.
And some written material from next week's episode of Game of Thrones. And more is promised soon.
It's a pretty small leak.
Okay.
The Sony hack was 100 terabytes. This is 1.5.
Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah. I think this, after the Netflix hack, that this, I think criminals feel like, oh, you know, we could probably get some money blackmailing these companies. The value of Game of Thrones. I don't, is it going to reduce the number of people who watch it if they knew what was going to happen? It's just going to piss people off.
Game of Thrones actively encouraged
piracy. Puts it back in the news. I mean,
they encourage it. Yeah. It is the most pirated TV show.
I was going to say, the first couple of series, they were like, yeah, we know it's one of the most pirated TV shows, and we're fine with that because it gets more people actually going out and watching it.
Wow, that's enlightened.
And, it was like, okay, well, no, fair enough. And it's worked. Everyone not everyone watches it, but a hell of a lot of people watch it. And piracy has helped build up that base of people who maybe they pirated the first couple of episodes and then they signed on and watched the next four or five. That said, we're still waiting for the final book. So.
Speaking of the Iron Throne, Travis Kalanick has hired three dragons and is about to attack Uber's
three
headquarters.
Male dragons.
apparently, this is from the information, big scoop from the information, he was prospecting among former employees and others to see if he should stage a proxy fight to try to get back in as CEO of Uber. Information says, well, he's not currently pursuing a shareholder battle because he hasn't asked anybody to sign any documents. But I wouldn't be surprised. They have yet to find a replacement for this guy. And all the women they've asked have said, hell no.
Yeah. I mean, they approached Sheryl Sandberg, and it was just like, you
kidding?
Well,
why would she do that?
Exactly.
Yeah. She's even already... Marissa Meyer. I mean, nobody wants that job.
No.
Meg Whitman.
Now, Meg Whitman could do it. She's got she's used to dealing with people and pushing through an agenda. She could do it, but why would she want to?
Yeah, she wouldn't. Yeah. And she took herself, didn't she take herself out of the right running during a board meeting when they were talking about her? I mean, she like tweeted, guys.
I don't usually comment on rumor, but I want to kill this one dead right now.
I mean, gender aside, I don't know who would, at this point, I don't even know who would want to step in to take that job, right? I mean, they're inheriting such a mess.
Isn't there a big upside, though, if you can turn it around? I mean, that's a company.
It's already valued at $60 billion. You know, I mean, like, what's the run-up, it was? I mean, there's rumors that SoftBank was buying out Benchmark for a 30% discount off of that. I mean, there could be a fairly long period of time where its value contracts before it rescales the great heights in, $70 billion, whatever. That was an advanced public market price back in the day, but it's already been valued very richly.
Right. Oh,
and
yeah.
If I'm Jeffrey Immelt, right? I mean, you've run, GE. That would be a crazy job to take on next.
Also, Uber isn't profitable. They're burning through a staggering amount of VC fund. I mean,
I don't think they have a lot of, even at that valuation, I don't think they have a lot of runway. I think it's a year.
It's more than a year, it's not a lot of years. It's like 2 years or something like that. I did the math a few months ago.
Can they go back again and say, give us more money? Or
sure, but it would be at a lower, if they did it tomorrow, it would be significantly lower. It would be a very dilutive transaction. It would be a significantly lower valuation. But sure, they could get money, but they'd probably throttle back the marketing as a first step. I think that's where a lot of the money goes.
Yeah. It's, as I say, if they really wanted to get a female CEO, they should get someone who's young, just below C grade, looking to make their mark, and then let them go for it. Going to an established
Piper?
Name like...
I think Piper Reese would be perfect. She takes Uber, we already know that.
A female CEO doesn't solve the problems that are endemic throughout the company.
Window dressing.
So,
and
honestly, he's going to try to stage a comeback. So anybody in their right, I would be surprised that they're going to get anybody who's going to be great, who'd be willing to take that job right now.
Yeah, he has a staggering amount of stock ownership. So his ability to wreak havoc in the boardroom, and there is definitely a history of CEOs that have been pushed out who re-engineered or engineered the return to the great detriment of the people who succeeded him. You know, and you know that's going to that will at least be attempted here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're really signing up for a doozy of a, yeah, of a brawl.
It's like sitting on the Iron Throne when you got three dragons coming your way. It's not, yeah. I'm sorry. I got Game of Thrones in mind. We got to let everybody go because back east, it's going to happen in about half an hour. We want to give Amy Webb
a
chance to get some popcorn, get some butter. Amy, it's been great having you again. Come back anytime. You're so smart. The book is The Signals Are Talking, Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream. She's not so smart in the sense that she's actually telling people how she does her job, which is probably not a good idea. She's the formula for being a futurist to your very own self. Actually, every science fiction author should read this. This would be a valuable, valuable tool. And it really is an engaging book. Thank you so much for being here, Amy. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I love being here. Thanks.
Good. Always welcome. And as are you, Mr. Ian Thompson, good friend. Nothing for me to plug except go read The Register. And I'm sure you'll be doing coverage, more coverage of Marcus's situation.
Yeah.
And we'll see what happens with Marcus Hutchins because I'm like, WannaCry killer. Is that what you decided to call him, the WannaCry killer?
Yeah.
That's, you know, understand that's the wrong connotation.
Well, it did
it's
also,
true.
It did also make a really unfortunate URL with just WannaCry killer. Martin's like, oh, no, hang on. No, we need to edit that. You
know? I want to cry. It's always a pleasure. Thank you for making your way up.
It was great.
Come back soon.
And some great, yes, fellow guests.
And also, yeah, congratulations to Rob Reed. The book just came out after on. I'm not done with it, but it is, you can't put it down. It's 547 pages of really, really good stuff and very challenging. Very exciting. Yeah. Besides being great fiction, it's smart fiction. And that's what Rob's going to be known for, I think, going forward. The Thomas Pynchon of Silicon Valley, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Rob, for being here. Give my best to Morgan. So you're living in New York for a while?
We've been in New York for over a year, and we're enjoying life. We kind of jokingly call it our junior year abroad in Manhattan, because it probably is temporary.
You're going to come back to California, or where will you end up, you think?
It's, you know, it's entirely possible.
If I were you,
yeah.
I'm just saying, Santorini, beautiful place.
Santorini,
yeah.
Greece.
Yeah. Lovely town. You could have a house with a blue roof.
I was last there in 1988 before they
had
the
airport. It's exactly the same.
Somehow I doubt that.
Santorini.
If I were you, you could live anywhere. You could be anywhere, right? Writers, that's the beauty of being a novelist.
You can be anywhere, yeah.
You can live anywhere. Anywhere in the world. Thank you all for being here. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time, 2200 UTC. If you want to join us in the studio, a great studio audience from all over the world, from Munich and Calgary, Canada, Indianapolis. And you guys just snuck in here. I don't know where you're from, but thank you all for being here. Email tickets at twit.tv, and we'll be glad to put a chair out for you. You can also watch the live stream from anywhere in the world, twit.tv/live. If you do that, though, I invite you to be in our chat room at irc.twit.tv. Join the kids, the wise-ass kids in the back of the class, throwing spitballs and stuff. That's what we do without them.
Oh, I always log on to the Twit thing. It's just
I know. You're one of the few guests who actually joins the chat.
Well, I've always watched it on the monitor, and I saw Ian watching it on the screen, so I pulled it up as well. It's kind of fun.
Oh,
it is. I even threw in a couple of...
We sometimes warn guests not to... Look.
I've always looked there, and it's never been that bad. Of course, now they're going to get me. CEO Barbie.
That's going to be the title of the show, guaranteed.
Oh, is it? CEO Barbie? Yep. That's pretty good.
CEO Barbie, yeah.
If you can't,
glad that's my contribution.
Good job, Amy. If you can't be here during the show's broadcast time, of course, you can watch On Demand. Everything we do, really, is about On Demand. So just go to twit.tv and download a copy. Or my favorite thing, however you listen to podcasts, find Twit and subscribe. That way, every Monday, you'll be ready. As you go into work, you'll have a nice Twit to listen to. And given the length of the show, you can listen to it all week long. anything else I need to say? Thank you, Karsten Bondi and Tanya Hall, for booking the show and putting the rundown together. Thank you, John Slanina, for making sure the microphones work. Thank you for being here. We'll see you next time. Another Twit is in the can. Bye-bye. Hey! Good job! Doing the Twit.